2022, and I'm David Knights, your host here at Prodigy FK CSI Dallas of the Journey Meeting. This is our monthly meeting that we do to get together and discuss the topic of the JFK assassination and also other topics, you know, come up as well. I'm joined by my co-host here, Casey Quinlan. Brian Edwards will hopefully be on a little bit later. He's taking care of some personal business. But, hey, we're all well. We're ready to start our show again. So with that, let me look here in the audience and make sure. Oh, there's my buddy Larry. Larry's going to come on first, and he's going to be discussing what's really great information and I think a key step in his work and also in the fact for all of us of getting the documents released. I'm going to turn it over to Larry here in just a quick second, and then later on, hopefully here in the first hour, we're going to have David Denton with us. And David's got pretty exciting news. We're going to have him on so that way he can talk about it, and then I'll have some follow-up information, and then we'll just kind of play it by ear and see how things go. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our friend Larry Snaff, and Larry, go ahead and take it away.
Thanks, David. I just want to make sure you're frozen on my screen. You can see me, right?
I can see you. Yep.
Okay, good. All right. Good afternoon, everybody. We definitely did miss the last installment of this wonderful ongoing program. David, I'm glad that you recovered and are back in the back feeling good. So let me start off by just reminding people that before President Biden had issued his memorandum further delaying the release of the JFK records, I had submitted a request to the National Archives for the underlying correspondence between President Trump, the National Archives, and the various agencies, the underlying correspondence that led up to the decision in both of his memos to postpone the release of the records, the assassination records. That was my attempt to try to backdoor into the files to see what records were being held back and why the agencies were asking for these records to be held back, plus any legal memorandum or any other justifications that were exchanged in writing amongst the various agencies. When NARA declined my request for an expedited review based on the, they said there was insufficient public interest in, that was the reason for denying my expedited review. I then got Mark Zay to file a lawsuit on my behalf, and then we amended it as soon as President Biden further postponed the release of the records to add that correspondence relating to his decision as well. So we had a status conference with the judge last week. And the government has agreed, first they indicated there were about 5,700 pages of documents. I don't know, you know, how much of those are assassination records and how much of those are correspondence memos, et cetera. But they identified that, and they then agreed that they will start releasing 250 pages a month. Now, whether those pages are redacted or whether in part or in whole remains to be seen. However, at the same time, I found this lessons learned memo that was issued by the CIA in 1999, which the topic was to lessons learned about the, you know, complying with the JFK Records Act and ARP in particular. And it was basically a roadmap as to what they've been doing since then in terms of how they're delaying and, you know, denying requests. But really interestingly, attached to this memo were two opinions from the Office of General Counsel, which said that the JFK Act was so broad that the typical two typical grounds for denying requests under FOIA, which is the deliberative process exemption and attorney-client privilege, were not applicable under the JFK Records Act. In other words, the government cannot use those grounds to refuse to release records under the JFK Records Act. So we took the position that any correspondence about assassination records are in by themselves assassination records. The government has not objected to that. They've agreed to release 250 pages a month. I have to double check with Mark's data as to when this is going to start. I have not disclosed this memo yet to the court. We're going to hold that as dry powder in the event that the government begins releasing redacted records. In other words, if they try to claim that we can't release this record in full because it's attorney-client privilege or because it's part of the deliberative process, well, then I'll use that document, which is the CIA's own opinion of their general counsel that they don't have that authority to hold back a record. So I should be starting to get 250 pages a month from the agencies. And these would be documents where the archives asks if it could release a certain document, and the agency would say, no, we don't want it released. They have to explain why. And then also might be any legal memoranda or other correspondence back and forth that led to this decision. Don't know how it's going to look, but that's, I think, a big, as Mark and Zade and Bill Simpich said, this was like amazing that they immediately caved at the first status conference. So that's potentially good news. We're just about to file a second FOIA request with the National Archives, asking them, well, David Ferreira, who's the current archivist, is retiring in March. And so the letter is asking him to follow up on the various recommendations that the ARB made in 1998 for follow-up requests with the agencies, to follow up on what was then ongoing processing of documents. So we're going to be filing, we have a whole list of, it's a two-page letter with an appendix that goes on another two pages of particular issues that we're asking Ferreira and maybe his successor to follow up on. Basically, we're asking them to comply with the JFK Records Act, do supplemental, there were certain files that were not searched. There were files that were in the process of being searched. And there's also efforts to get records from foreign agencies. The Department of State basically stopped requesting when ARP went out of business. So these are all basically outstanding requests that were not completed when ARB went out of business. So we're filing that request next week. If they don't respond, we'll add that to our lawsuit. So that's another potential archives lawsuit. And then we're still working on our complaint against Biden for his memo. Quite frankly, we're looking for a good plaintiff. Just a bunch of lawyers, even if we organize ourselves as a JFK legal task force or a JFK records task force or whatever, we have not been in the business of archiving and JFK records research and conferences and stuff like what's going on here. Is there a reason for that? Okay. So we're looking for a good plaintiff for our claim. That's basically where we are right now. We've reached out to a couple of 501c3s, and we're trying to get one of them or several of them comfortable with putting their name on the complaint. So as soon as we find a suitable plaintiff, we will then file our complaint. So that's where we are in terms of our litigation. And let me see, Joseph Bax, looking for a plaintiff. What does that mean? So we need an entity that can survive a motion to dismiss, because what the government's initially going to do when we file this complaint is they're going to look for a ground to knock us out of court without even getting to the merits of our case. And the way they do that is to argue that you don't have any standing to be in court. You don't have any right to be in court. And this happens a lot in environmental cases, which I'm obviously familiar with, where, say, an environmental organization brings a lawsuit against the company saying they're polluting a river, and they have to show that they have a member. They have to show that they somehow are damaged in a special way. So usually the way that's shown is that there's a member of the organization who uses the river, or, you know, unable to use the river, or perhaps it's polluting their property or something, some reason to be able to stay in court. This is a tool that courts use to kind of keep their dockets manageable. So when entities that are in the business of you know, reporting on historical records, and if they're in the business, then obviously they have economic impacts because it affects their membership, it affects their ability to conduct the business that they've been set up to do. So organizations like, say, Mary Farrell or Lancer or Kappa or ARC, those are the kind of organizations that could be good plaintiffs. There are issues with each one of those organizations, which I won't get into here. But we're trying to figure out which is the best fit for our case that will help us survive a motion to dismiss. Because once, you know, if you don't win a motion to dismiss, your lawsuit's over. It's basically dismissed on the papers without actually getting into the merits of the case. And we want to be able to have a plaintiff that will be able to say to the court, look, I'm in the business of, you know, investigating records and maintaining archives and distributing to our members. We get membership dues. We sell stuff. You know, this is an economic issue as well. And we therefore have special damages as resulting from these decisions to postpone records. So I hope that, Joseph, that it helps you a little bit understanding what the issues are. David, there's a bunch of questions in the chat. Do we want to talk about them now, or should we wait till later on?
No, let's go ahead and talk about the questions. But before we go there, let me ask you, now these 250 pages that you spoke of earlier, are they going to be basically pulling 250 pages and then making a decision, then making a release on NARA's website? Or, and I know that you just said that, you know, we're kind of wondering how the process is going to work, but do you have an idea? I mean, are they going to be releasing 250 pages every month, or is this going to be, you know, like a sporadic type of release?
So, first of all, it's not going to be the record itself. It's going to be correspondence about the record, which could give us enough information to understand why they're withholding them, right? So they have to explain, for example, record A, we're asking not to continue to withhold it because it presents an imminent substantial endangerment or imminent risk to national security. And they have to explain what that is and why it does that. So we're hoping that for each document, we will get sort of like a summary of what the issues are. And we don't know the level of detail that they go into to justify this position. So it won't be the record itself, but it'll be the correspondence, maybe legal memoranda, emails, you know, why we'll find out who is requesting the withholding, why they're requesting it. Those are the kind of things we'll get, but we won't get the actual record. But it might actually be able to give us grounds for a follow-up as part of our lawsuit with the president about the decision. It might help our case in terms of saying why we believe that President Biden failed to comply with the JFK Records Act. The email understanding that was issued indicated they would be issuing 250 pages per month. The reason that they limited to 250 was because of resources in COVID. So they told us there were roughly 5,700 pages that were relevant to my ask, and that they would be issuing 250 pages per month. I have to find out from Mark exactly. I think the commitment was somewhere in the spring they would start. So they would be releasing it to me. I obviously would be sharing it with the JFK community, because there's a lot of people here that have much more knowledge than I do about some of the fine-tuned issues, but that's what we anticipate. Now, whether there's going to be, say, an email that says, we are requesting this record to be withheld because, and then that gets blacked out, that's to be seen.
And will that be something that, is it privileged between, you know, like lawyer privilege, or can we actually put that on the website so everybody can read what they send you?
Well, if I get a document that has, that's redacted, and I would then ask why is it redacted, and if they say attorney-client privilege, then that's when I bring out the CIA memo that indicates that they cannot redact, under the JFK Records Act, they cannot redact information based on attorney-client privilege. That is not, it's not like FOIA. FOIA has specific exclusions. The JFK Records Act is very powerful. It, you know, there's another issue that we're struggling with, that there's no, when Jim Lazar brought some actions under the JFK Records Act in the 90s, the courts ruled there was no private right of action to enforce the law, but that was also at the time that ARB was in existence. And this is potentially a very powerful statute that we could use, because it's much broader than the Freedom of Information Act. There's less grounds. The only grounds for not releasing a document is that it poses an imminent risk of harm to national security, or there are certain grounds for, like, taxes, tax records, and also materials that were subject to a deed of trust, like records from the Kennedy family that, you know, were granted under certain conditions. And then also that it would put at risk a member of the intelligence community. But those are grounds, but they have to prove those grounds. But the other grounds, like attorney-client privilege, or this is part of deliberative decision-making, which is a common ground that agencies use not to comply with FOIA or not to release the record. Those grounds, their attorney-client privilege and deliberative process, are not grounds for withholding a record under the JFK Records Act. So we're going to really try to use the might of the JFK Records Act as much as possible here.
Okay, Larry, go ahead and I know Joe's got his hand up here. Joe, I'm going to get to you in just a second. Go ahead and answer some of those questions that you got there in front of you, Larry. And then, Joe, I'll have you come on and you can add to what you want to talk to Larry about.
Okay, well, Joe, you have a question here. How will you get these 250 pages a month? Is it in hard copy or scanned in PDF? Don't know. We haven't got that detail yet. Presumably it's going to be emailed to me. Explain what's looking for a plaintiff. What do you mean? Let's see. Are Trump and Biden not in compliance because they did not specify the reason for denial, or because they gave more time? So the reason we believe that they did not comply with the JFK Records Act by not identifying the grounds, the specific grounds why each record was postponed. The act requires that for each record postponed past the October 2017 date, that they have to specify the grounds. And instead, both Trump and Biden just made a blanket assertion that release of these records would, you know, have a negative impact on national security. But they were supposed to make that on a document-by-document basis. Now, the government's going to argue that they can do that. There are two sections of the law that apply to these postponements, so Section 5 and Section 6. And there's a bit of ambiguity as to how they interact with each other. So we've anticipated that, but that's the reason that we believe that that Trump and Biden failed to comply with the act, because they didn't go through this document-by-document explanation and disclose that to the public. Let's see, anything else? I think that's it, David, in terms of the chats that were related to my presentation.
Okay, Joe. I appreciate that, Larry. Joe, go ahead and ask what you wanted to ask or add to the conversation.
Do you have a list of RIF numbers to ask for documents? Do you have a long list of RIF numbers that you're going to ask, or are you just asking in general?
Well, for the first, for the current settlements, I asked for underlying correspondence, memos, emails relating to all of the records that were subject to the orders. So I don't have a specific RIF number, but there was a broad-based request that for any document that was withheld, I want the underlying correspondence that, you know, about the decision making that led to the postponement of those records.
All right, I think I can give you a list. I'll work on it, but I've got a long list for you.
Okay, I'm actually going to, you know, I think I'm going to send you a copy of the letter we're about to send to NARA, requesting information for further either supplemental requests or follow up with the outstanding requests that were in effect when ARB went out of business, to the extent that you, because you're one of the experts in this area. Rex took a look at it, but between you and Rex, I think we would cover the universe. So I'll send that to you for your review, and you can let me know if you have any other suggestions. We have an appendix of specific areas when we're asking for document searches.
Can I add maybe something? I don't know if I'm right about this or not. I'd love to be corrected, but the records that were released in the 90s, 96, 98, etc., I haven't seen those digitized. That's why the Blunt files, for instance, are covered into files that aren't recognized online at all, whether through a search of RIF number or, you know. And a lot of that is basically seen as not online by checking the RIFs, and you know, and partly like non-existent whatsoever, no notes of it in the Federal Register and so forth. So it's quite a bit of a quagmire, that element. But is there any attempt to find out whether this stuff has actually been ever digitized as such from the late 90s, basically, those batches that did get
released? So the one good thing in the Biden order was this commitment to digitize the entire collection in 2 years. And there actually was a proposed plan, I believe, submitted in December for this project. It was prepared by the archivist. So they do, you know, there is a plan from 2022 to 2023. Now, whether they're going to stay on schedule is another question. They're always, you know, as far as I know, as of 2 weeks ago, the archives are still shut down because of COVID. So they've been using that as an excuse for not complying. So if they comply with their schedule, now obviously the other problem is that David Ferrer was leaving at the end of March. He was supportive of this effort. Both the digital project was his baby, plus also I think he wanted to get this JFK project off his plate. We don't know how long it's going to take to find a new archivist, whether the archivist is going to be as committed as Ferrari is to his project. So I suspect there's going to be some slippage in the deadline. I'm just as a normal human bureaucratic, you know, behavior. But they do, presumably, the records you're referring to would become digitized as part of this project. The entire collection is supposed to be digitized.
Oh, shall I look forward to that?
Yes, that was something when we learned a week before the Biden order was issued, we learned from our contacts what was going to happen. And they were really excited about the digitized. They thought that was really big. They internally were excited about it, that this is going to be, in their mind, it was more important than when the records are released. So they're excited. Right, we'll see.
And they are. Yeah, I mean, until I see it, I don't believe it. Simple as that. So, you know.
Trust and verify, right?
Politicians talk.
David, everyone is frozen. Is that something on my end then?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, okay. I think you might want to possibly once you get done with everything, go ahead and log out, log back in, and hopefully that will change. Because yeah, we're all moving around and stuff, but and we can see you and you're fully animated, but there may be a glitch on your internet connection or
everyone froze for me for a second too, but you're back to normal now.
Okay.
So does anybody else have any other questions for Larry Snapp?
Yeah, I've got one. Larry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Have you considered any authors or potential authors as, you know, parties as far as being persons of interest? Because in that case, you know, somebody, if an author was purposefully holding back on releasing his book until he has more information, that would definitely be an economic impact on the author.
Yeah, we've thought about that, and that is a possible backup strategy, but the best we're looking to be as bulletproof as possible in terms of surviving a motion to dismiss. So probably an organization would be better, but we'd have to find an author that is in the process of writing a book as opposed to like a Tink Thompson has already written his book, right?
Right.
So that is the backup. What we're focusing right now on getting one of the JFK organizations comfortable, you know, with being a plaintiff, there are, you know, the board members have legitimate concerns about being a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the government. So it could jeopardize relationships, although I don't think so, but, you know, people have, and then you have, you know, varying, your board members have to sign on and, you know, you need a majority and some places need a unanimous. So we're working through that. But yes, authors are a potential secondary plaintiff if we can't get the optimal plaintiff.
Gotcha.
Okay, does anybody else have any questions for Larry? Well, definitely as the information comes on, again, look at projectjfk.com and in the and hold on, I should have already had this pulled up, but let me pull this up real quick.
You guys are on a 501c3, right? You're just like an informal organization?
No, actually, we're not 501c3. I've been looking at that, but then again, I haven't done anything with adding that to it. But okay. Let me click share screen.
Okay, so in the hierarchy of things, it's better to have a 501c3 regular entity, and then there's you know, then there's unincorporated entities,
right.
And then there's individuals. So we're trying to figure out, we just want to try, because we know this is the first thing the government's going to do. They'll be very aggressive about it. So we're trying to get as bulletproof as possible, and, you know, we'll keep in touch. I'm going to log out and log back in because everyone's frozen. I'm hoping that they'll unfreeze when I come back in.
Okay, that'd be great, Larry. And while you're doing that, for anybody that wants to look, and of course I've got Larry's name misspelled right here. I just noticed that. I will change that. But if you go to Project JFK, I wrote it right up here, just not down here. My fingers didn't move as fast. But if you go to ProductGFK.com, click on the blog section and information from Larry Snaff and the downloads, you'll be able to find that there. And then, of course, our blogs are down below that. But this will be where you will find information. And I know I have some updates to do. So, again, check on the blog section, and you'll see from the Desk of Larry Snaff section on there, and then you'll be able to see what what's getting released to Product JFK from Larry, and then you'll be able to read it for, well, secondhand, I guess. But that way you'll be able to see it. So, yeah, Larry, go ahead and log out and then log back in. I'll let you back in the room. And with that, yeah.
And so, by the way, as soon as I get the letter, the supplemental letter to Ferrara out, which should be Monday or Tuesday, I'll give it to you to post it on the site.
Okay, that'd be great. That'd be great. Thank you, Larry.
Be back in a minute.
All righty. See you soon. Okay, I see that David Denton is in our room here. So let me see. David, are you ready to go? Your microphone's on mute. Hold on. You're muted, David.
I was trying to make the conversion from my phone to the computer, and I logged off. You probably see me bouncing around here, but I think I – can everybody see me? Okay.
Yep, we can see you. All right, with that, this is David Denton from professor at Olney Central College and also a researcher and author. So, David, go ahead and give us the exciting news.
Yeah, and I just want to – We've been in collaboration, the JFK Historical Group, with Project JFK, the great guys, Dave Knight and Casey and Brian Edwards, and we are ready to go ahead and put a conference together at my campus at Olney Central College in Olney, Illinois. Our dates are April 8 and 9. It will be a hybrid event. In that we will offer a Zoom, but we're also offering in person. And that hasn't been done in a while. I know it's been difficult for folks to get out. And that's the primary reason why we've waited this long. We probably justifiably could have put something out a month ago, but we've collaborated on a couple projects trying to get things going in Kansas City the last couple of years, and COVID has basically shot us down. So before we made a financial and commitment to speakers and everyone, we wanted to make certain that a brighter picture, at least in terms of COVID, would be apparent. And we feel like things are looking better where we can have a live event. We've already lined up some good speakers, excellent speakers, and we're still in the process of recruiting in that respect. But, obviously, the Project JFK guys will be there. Again, Casey, Brian, and Dave. I will be presenting. I believe right now we have a commitment from Gary Shaw, who's always an excellent researcher out of Texas, who always has some intriguing things to offer. And we're looking at several other folks as well. And I know some have probably been. We've had a couple events before at my campus. Some of you have been, maybe many of you haven't. I mean, we're basically a smaller community in central Illinois. I wouldn't say we're conveniently located, but it's a great venue if you can make it. Right now we're going to be offering, open admission for those who show up in person. We'll have a large contingent of college and high school students. It will be held at our Olney Central College Theater, which is a great venue. A lot of good things. We got a brand new hotel located right next to our campus. We'll be putting out some press release on it probably midweek. If you're interested, if you're looking at that, we'll have hotel information. We'll also, as I say, offer a stream, a Zoom, and that'll be offered on Project JFK. I think we settled on a modest fee for that at $40. And, again, since we have a lot of college and high school students and local community people and because of the late date and event, if you are a person that's inclined to maybe come in person, it will be a free admission for the weekend. It will go from, I think 10 o'clock Friday morning, April 8th, all the way through that evening and then through Saturday afternoon. And, the focus will be on, well, my class has always been entitled, I teach a college class, Political Assassinations of the 1960s. And I think the last few events we've had, we try to stay true to that. And, we will, be focusing primarily on the assassinations of JFK, the new documents released that Larry's just been talking about. I've kind of done a compilation of some of the things that I've looked at the last 3 years, articles. I've written articles about it, put a narrative to some of the new document releases, and we look forward to more. We will have Ryan Jones, who is the resident historian at the King Memorial site. He's given some presentations via Zoom in the last couple of things. He is fantastic in terms of his presentation. He will be presenting on the MLK assassination. So there's a lot of good opportunities. I hope that you would consider joining us one way or another via Zoom or hopefully in person. Again, we're in central Illinois. Best flight options are Indianapolis or St. Louis. They're both a couple hours away. So it's not an easy, I'm not saying we live out on the edges of Montana or anything, but you know, we've got a nice community, about 10,000. It's a fantastic place. I think we had an event there 3 years ago and everybody just, I got a lot of positive feedback from all those who were able to make it, and I hope you would consider. And if you have any information, I tell you what, Dave, I was thinking about just trying to put up, or if you're interested in trying to put up my email address, maybe if I just showed that on the screen. I wish I had more technical stuff to show in front of you. We will have a press release midweek. We will put that out on Facebook and send, we got an extensive email address. If you want more information about it, please email me. I don't know if I could, my email address is DentonD@.
Let me put that on here in the chat log.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. If you got the tech, better just put it up on the screen.
Well, I can't do it on the screen, but I'll put it in the chat log for everybody. It's Denton D.
Yeah.
What's the at?
At IECC dot EDU.
Okay. I just put that in the chat log for everybody.
Yeah. Please, don't hesitate to email me, or even I'll put my phone number out there too, Dave. I mean, it's 618-204-1498, and we'll send you info about the event. Love to do it. And speaking of Dave, I mean, you know it's going to be a great conference because you got a guy like this running the technical aspects behind it, and Dave is superb, and he'll be on site running all our technical, our stream, our Zoom, and right there, as I said, you know, it'll be a first-class operation from that respect. So we just invite everyone to consider joining us. It should be a really good event. And, again, any questions, certainly get with me. Dave,
okay,
if anybody's got any questions, I'm here. You know, I'll be glad to answer them.
Appreciate that, David. Let me add a couple things to that. On the projectjfk.com website in the events tab, this week, as soon as David gets it to me, I will be putting it on the website. There'll be a Eventbrite sign up. So those that can't travel or don't want to travel, but they do want to take part in the event, again, we're going to go with $40 on, it'll be done through Zoom. Now, if anybody watched the presidential, basically where they were having people, some people in person and then other people at home coming in on Zoom. I'm going to do the exact same thing to an extent. You'll be able to actually see everything that's going on at the university in what, basically what's going on in person. You'll be able to see it streamed on Zoom. And then you'll also be able to, when there is time for Q&A, if the speakers wish to take Q&A, you'll actually be able to interact with that speaker as if you were there in person. They'll be able to see you. You'll be able to see them. And so, like I say, we'd like to have people come out for sure. And like David said, it's free admission in person. You basically just got to pick up your hotel and your travel expense on that part of it. But, you know, if you choose to join us on Zoom, this is going to go global. So, you know, anybody, no matter where they're at, I know we have some people that like Bart that's overseas, you know, they'll still be able to partake in the event here on Zoom. But like I say, as soon as the information gets to me, I will be building the part on the events tab and you'll be able to sign up. And then depending on how many people we have, you know, if you go ahead and purchase and sign up for it, try to do that as soon as you can. So that way we know how many to expect. Cause I know with our current plan with Zoom, we can have about, you know, 100 people in the room. And if we need to purchase more, we'll purchase more seats for people to be able to attend. If we don't need to, then you know, it's a cost we don't have to take on. But definitely more information will be coming this week, and you'll be able to, of course, get a hold of David through email or through his phone that's in the chat log. And if you have any questions for me, you can always email me at projectjfk@yahoo.com, or you can always call me at 913-980-JFK1. So, David, I appreciate that, and thank you for coming on and giving us the exciting news.
Dave, I just noticed somebody came up with a question about, you know, we'll put the hotel information in, but if you're looking for that information now, again, then there's a question, when is the conference? Again, it is April 8th and 9th. That's a Friday and Saturday, April 8th and 9th. And then someone else asked about, I can tell you up front, the hotel that's the brand new hotel sitting adjacent to our college is the Best Western Plus. That's in Olney, Illinois, O-L-N-E-Y. It's Best Western Plus. And that hotel is going to probably run you about $90 a night. It's pretty important, but they're obviously, there's a couple hotels in town that are more affordable than that. It's a little farther away. I think there's a Super 8 about 7 or 8 blocks from the college and another local hotel about a mile from the college. So, and those hotels will be in the $50 or $60 range. So they're very affordable. And, again, I'll try to put all that information on a release. If you you can also follow me on Facebook. If you haven't already, I know I've got about 800 JFK followers on Facebook already. We will put them in the JFK groups too. So you should see something on Facebook this week, midweek, in terms of all details. Okay. And again, thanks again, Dave. Appreciate it.
Appreciate that, David. And I put that information in the chat as he was speaking. So like I say, look forward to that, in April. And, for anybody that hasn't been to Olney, I know, what we had a couple years ago, most people flew into, St. Louis, Missouri, and then just drove. It's a couple hour drive from St. Louis to, Olney. But it's a great little town, and, you know, we had a lot of fun, putting on the conference the last time. And hey, for anybody that's, you know, into nature, you may get a chance to finally see a white squirrel, because that's a big thing in that town, white squirrel.
And you mentioned the airports. Indianapolis is probably a bit closer. The airport's about 2 hours away, straight shot, no city traffic or anything. St. Louis Airport's about 220. That's, you know, as far as the major airports that can get you to Olney. There's also an airport in Evansville that's about 80 miles away, but that's pretty much a whole airport you're going to have to connect to get to. But we'll try to get all that information on as we go forward.
Yeah, absolutely, David. And hey, for those that like to drive, like me, I don't fly, but it's not a bad road trip either. It's kind of like you're making the quest across the United States, depending on where you're coming. So yeah, with that, thank you, David, again.
Thank you.
We'll have more information out on the website, like I say, later this week. Anybody has any questions, get a hold of me or David. We'll get you taken care of. Our next person I'd like to bring on real quick. I think Craig is still in the room here. Craig's working on something that we talked about together, and I've mentioned it before, but I have him in my email now. These journey meetings, spotlight series, conferences, and so on, he is actually helping us out by taking the bull by the horns, because, hell, I've been busy with scanning the Dick Russell collection, which we are literally this close to being finished. We have, like, two boxes left to scan, making a master list that will be out on the website prior to the documents that will be searchable PDFs, plus the part of the website that will give you the opportunity to be able to search that collection, which will be happening here probably within the next few months to 6 months, but it's happening this year for sure. It'll also be on Baylor's website. Now, how they put it out there is a little bit beyond me. I don't think it's going to be searchable like the way we're doing it, but we'll have to see when it gets out there. But Craig is working on, some people requested a transcript. So that way, in case they don't get a chance to, watch the whole thing, or they want to go back and see exactly what somebody else said, he's in the process of making transcripts of some of our programs. So, Craig, if you're available, can you tell us a little bit about your project that you're working on for us?
Yeah, so far I've gone through all the Spotlight series and gone through the rigmarole to get them into a transcript. And what I basically do is through YouTube, they have a transcript that is very raw. It has no punctuation, no capitalization, nothing. It's like 1 3-hour long run-on sentence. I also subscribe to a service that does a really, much better job as far as capitalization, punctuation. However, YouTube does a slightly better job at recognizing the words. So I actually wrote a program that compares the two and brings over the punctuation from the one with the words of the other. And where there's a difference, it shows me that there's, the two services are not agreeing with each other. So I know to, when I'm reviewing it manually to make sure I, that something's wrong. Now, both services do a horrible job with names. Like Hosty is something that you would think would be easy like that. It botches all the time. So most of the names I have to go in and manually fix up. So I, after I run it through my process, I get basically a Word document that shows the combined results of the two transcribing services with a highlight of what the differences are. And then I play the stuff back and then manually make any corrections in Word. So I have just finished all the Spotlight series, and I'll talk to Dave offline. What we can do now is to, what other things, it is a little bit of a time consuming effort to do. So, whether it's the Journey series, whatever, we can talk about what else I should do.
Yeah, and Craig, I will be contacting you after the meeting ends today. I'm sorry I put you off the last few times you've given me a call, but I will be giving you a call after we get done with the Journey meeting today, and we can discuss that. But I want to show everybody real quick here on Prodigy FK's website. you will be able to click share here. You'll be able to go to the events tab. And of course, I'm sure everybody's pretty well familiar with how our events tab works, but it's color coded. So the journey meetings are all in black for the background. You can find the chat logs that will be as downloadable here. And again, also, some people requested MP3 so they could download it to their device and take it with them. The journey spotlight's in red. And again, also in this area, you've got Bill Simmons' virtual handout downloads, the chat logs, the MP3s. Well, Craig's section, and it'll be transcripts by Craig Bozarth. There'll be a section where you'll be able to take the file and download it, and then you can print it off, you can save it on your device, you'll be able to have that. It'll be found in the section. I know he said he has a spotlight done first, so we're going to put those up, try to get those all put online this week as I'm making changes to the website. I've got a lot of stuff to add to it. David Denton's conference material information will be going on there. On this page, Craig's transcripts are going to go on here. And I personally want to thank Craig for taking the time. I know, you know, anything you do with the JFK assassination research, you know, anything that you do with that, it is time consuming. But we do this for a reason. We do this to get the information out there and, you know, to help the community be able to, you know, keep researching and, you know, anything that we can do to add to it. I know when Craig, you know, we talked about it and, you know, it was definitely a great idea. And we're like, say, we'll have those up. I think we're going to have those up this week for sure, Craig. And, but again, I will contact you offline today. As soon as we get done with the meeting, give me about probably 30 minutes and then I'll make a phone call to you.
Okay. And also, if there's any authors out there, you know, after the spotlights are posted, that, you know, read through their own and say, hey, I'd like this corrected, you know, let us know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Craig, again, thank you for taking the time and the effort and the hours that it takes to create one, you know, the transcripts. It's I think it'll be very helpful for the people that want to, maybe they don't have time, they don't want to go back and rewatch the whole thing, but they want to be able to pull information out. I think it's a great thing to do. And with that, I'm going to now call on Mark Macario. He sent me a message here in the chat log that he's got something he'd like to talk about, and I think it's pretty exciting. So, Mark, if you're available, go ahead and unmute yourself and tell us what kind of conversation you had recently.
Yeah, I'm here. Basically, David Lipton has a GoFundMe page, and he's, you know, soliciting money to finish his book, Final Charade. So I donated some money, not, you know, not a whole lot. I think maybe 100 or so. But after you donate, he has a monthly, he's just starting a monthly Zoom meeting where you can, and there was only like 5 or 6 people on it, and you could go ask him questions about, you know, any kind of subject. And so basically it was less than an hour long, but I was the only one asking questions. Most of the people just said, you know, thank you and this and that. But I asked him a number of questions, and I wanted to, I have 4 areas that I like to go over, and they're not very long. I just wanted to get everybody's opinion. The first question, obviously, I asked them was, when was the book coming out, Final Charade? And I didn't get a straight answer. He's still working on it. So I just hope he doesn't get, you know, too old to be able to finish it, because I have been, you know, waiting for it. So I believe has a number of other people. So the first question I asked him, because he made a statement, he did a short presentation, was he was sure that a Secret Service agent was killed that day. And I dismissed that like 30 years ago. I could be mistaken, but I wanted to get everybody's opinion. I went back and looked at it And apparently there was some kind of teletype message about a Secret Service agent being killed, but David is convinced that someone was killed. I don't know who it was. So if anybody has any feedback on that, and what's your opinion? Anybody?
I think it grew out of early reports. People saw a red stain up on the top of Dealey Plaza near where Abraham Zapruder was filming. It was most likely a red soda that a couple was eating lunch at. This was been dismissed years ago. But these things have a life of their own, and some of these things don't die out. But there's no proof of a Secret Service man being killed. There's no name associated with a Secret Service agent being killed. There's no known missing Secret Service agent. So it's just a story. It's like a zombie blight in politics. It just won't die.
Well, he's convinced that someone was killed. So a Secret Service agent was killed. So we'll find out when the book comes out.
The date and time. Do you have the time when that telex was sent? Because that might support what Joseph just said.
No, but I did look it up. I can get it. It happened within like a 30 minutes or so. So it happened fairly quickly. I thought that someone might have reported Clint Hill, laying over the limousine as opposed to, thinking maybe a Secret Service agent got shot, but I don't know. But yeah, I can look that up again.
The early reports. I mean, there was a lot of confusion in the early reports. People heard about a Dallas police officer dying and they didn't have a location. Some thought he died in Dealey Plaza. Some thought he died when Oswald was arrested, some other locations. Just the confusion of the early reports.
Yeah, well, I dismissed it 30 years ago, but apparently David Lifton is going to make a big deal out of it. So we'll see.
Mark, this is Casey Quinlan. I just wanted to point out a couple things. Some of the research that I've done, I've kind of put back on the back burner, and I've kind of dismissed some of that. I even went through the possibilities, the different types of drinks that were actually in glass bottles at that time, and even did kind of a history of what types of bottles were even there at that particular time. And I've broken it down to like a knee-high bottle that was either red soda or a raspberry soda, and that it was dropped by one of the women who were back there at that particular time. Now, that story goes on and on, as Joe has said. But then again, I've also talked to some of the individuals who first saw and went back there and said that it wasn't a Coke or it wasn't red soda. It was a blood. That's what they said. They said they put their fingers in it and they said it was more like blood. And I'm sitting there going, okay. So, you get two to three different ends of the spectrum here. And then you also have the possibility of ambulances running all over the place in the back of the Texas School Book Depository building and then on several different areas. But again, I think a lot of people have shuffled those things off as hearsay and innuendo. I know that I have to an extent, but ever since I've been reading some new books and new material, I'm sitting there going, okay, maybe we ought to take a look at some of this. But at the same time, I would agree with Joe's, not 100%, but I would agree with the idea that most of us have put this on the back burner. But there's a handful of people that still believe that was blood back there. But does that mean the Secret Service agent was back there? Well, we do know that there are people that have said that they met Secret Service agents on the Knoll. They met them coming down from the Knoll, and this is the North Grassy Knoll. And we know that there several Secret Service agents identified themselves in and around the Texas School Book Depository building. But we also know that the correct information on that, and I'm trying to figure out what is correct information in this day and age, is that some of them were supposedly false Secret Service agents and used false false identification. So, I mean, when you throw that in there, it becomes kind of a messy situation. And that's one thing we haven't looked at for a long time. And I'm saying maybe we ought to look at some of that. But at the same time, I would probably go along a little bit with what Joe has said.
Yeah. Well, again, I just missed it, but apparently David's going to make a big deal out of it next, when the book ever comes out. The next question is, he's making a big deal of the limo stopping after the Stemmons, after the triple underpass and before the Stemmons freeway. He's going to make a big deal out of the car stopping and something happened in the car at that time. I have no information on that. Does anybody know anything about that?
Well, again, Mark, I do, and Brian Edwards and I put a book out on one of our individuals who was a deaf mute, and that was Ed Hoffman. Hoffman, when we took Ed down to Dealey Plaza, and we wanted him to show us exactly where he walked, what he was doing, and by walking over that entire area, he said, okay, he says, my God, he says, I just remember where I went and things of this nature. And so he got up on Stemmons Freeway, and I think maybe Gary Shaw might attest to this a little bit too, but he got up on Stemmons Freeway, and right away, the first thing I noticed was about 6 to 7 car lengths on I-35, basically, Stemmons Freeway, that were going by probably about 60 to 65 miles an hour. Of course, this is not 1963, but at the same time, what I noticed about that, and as a hearing person, it kind of threw me because I'm sitting there going, why in God's name would you be up into a situation like this? Well, he can't hear, okay? And I could hear the cars coming and zooming by, so he couldn't hear. But he told us at that particular time this would have been the best spot that he could possibly see JFK, but he couldn't see him in the actual plaza until the car came underneath the triple underpass. And then he's standing on Stemmons Freeway where the entrance to Stemmons Freeway toward Dallas and then to the trademark where the car came underneath there. And he said the car stopped. Mm-hmm. He said the car stopped momentarily. And he says, I was probably about 15 feet away. I could look right inside the limo itself. And if that's what David's going to bring out, then I assume that that's what he's going to talk about. And maybe, in fact, Ed said that there was some commotion with the Secret Service agents as to where they were supposed to go. If they had taken the left-hand turn to Fort Worth, that Fort Worth exit would have taken them to, I think, the Methodist Hospital at that particular time, which would have been closer than Parkland. But they were already on the route toward Parkland. So, I mean, it's one of those things that you actually have an eyewitness there who saw that. And then Ed, when he was talking to us, he goes, oh, my God, he says, I just remembered this. The car stopped.
Aside from normal human behavior of being shocked by a shotgun and maybe the driver taking his foot off the pedal or putting a brake on, are you trying to attach any significance to the fact the car stopped?
Larry, are you asking me?
I'm asking this Mark.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
David said that the car stopped after it went around the triple underpass, and then he said he's got some more witnesses in addition to Ed Hoffman that said there was some kind of activity that happened in the car before it went on to the freeway. That's all he said.
After it passed the underpass, and right before it went on the exit.
Right.
Okay, well, all right.
We'll find out.
Did he say there was did he think of any significance of that?
Yes, he put the great significance on it, but I tried to press him, and he said it's going to be in the book. So.
Okay.
Real quick question for Casey at this point of when you were at the position where Ed Hoffman was, Casey, do you recall how was the view behind the fence that Ed Hoffman reports?
Okay, Brian Edwards and I did a tremendous amount of measurements, and we even went out on a golf course to hit a golf ball about somewhere between 150 yards to about 220 yards, which I can do and so can Brian, but at the same time, trying to see that white ball out on the fairway, okay? Well, that's, we could see it out there, but you've got great background. At the same time, in the measurements that we took from where Ed was at that particular time, it was anywhere from probably, I'm going to say 200 yards, at the least, maybe 180 yards, and then to the corner of the picket fence on the North Grassy Knoll, which was right next to the steps, maybe about 250 yards. Now, could we see that when Ed was there? The answer was no, and I'm going to tell you why. Because of the outgrowth and the overgrowth of all of the trees and everything that was there. But we could actually see the cars back there at that particular time. Now, I remember going back there, and Ed said, yeah, he says, I could see right back there, and he says, I could see, he said he saw somebody that he thought fired a shot, and they turned around, and he saw a guy smoking. But he could distinguish if it was a male or female. And he said that, and all I did was report that that's what he said. And now, do I believe it? I do. But at 200 yards, 180 yards, yeah, I mean, I could see a golf ball if I actually hit it on the fairway, which God forbid, if that ever happened, it'd be great, but mine's always in the rough. So.
Thank you.
Another question was, he believes that it's going to come out that Oswald was involved in some kind of cryptography while he was in Minsk, and he was doing things for the federal government. Anybody hear anything about that? Because I haven't.
I've certainly read a lot that everything Oswald was there on behalf of the federal government, one of the probably the CIA. Just generally, whether his activities were cryptography or otherwise, I don't recall off the top of my head.
Yeah, I don't remember reading anything about it. The last item was he's under the belief that the Zapruder film was altered. And I questioned, when he said that, I questioned him, and I said, if you're going to alter the Zapruder film, you also have to alter the Nix and the Muchmore film. So the question and he didn't answer that. So my question is, has anybody ever tried to sync the three films together to determine whether or not the Zapruder film has been altered, and was there a major stop on the Zapruder film and not on the other two films? Has anybody done any research into that?
This is Bob from New York, Mark. I'm a good friend of Bob Groden, and I can comment on it, but that work was actually done with photographic synchronization by Bob back in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It's available. I have a copy of it, I think I could provide you. It shows basically a frame-by-frame attempt at synchronization. Mm-hmm. Among the three films by breaking them into, in a single view, four quadrants, one being the Zapruder film, another is a Zapruder film close up, and the other two being the films you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And all analysis up to now suggests that they are all in time sync, making it a little bit troubling to try to think that one film might have been altered and the others not.
That's what I mentioned to him, and he just said, well, it was altered. So I don't believe that it was altered either, but again, he's going to come up with something in his book. So we'll see.
Mark, yeah. On YouTube, one could search for 2003, I think in the University of Minnesota or Wisconsin, Dave Lifton, David Mantic, Frank Costello, someone Costello, It was a multi-day analysis of evidence of alteration in the Zapruder film, and a few years ago it was still on YouTube. And before, and as soon as we move on, I'll go and search right now. It's many, many hours, but it's three or four folks who are really presenting quite compelling evidence that the film was quite altered.
Was altered quite a bit. Okay. That's all I had. The only other thing I was going to mention, David Denton's going to have Ryan Jones on his conference. I had him. I taught a class last year on the MLK and RFK assassination, and I had Ryan Jones, and he was the I got more compliments on his appearance than any other guest speaker I've ever had. So he's great. That's all I had. There's another meeting tonight. I'll go back and ask him some of these questions.
Well, Mark, appreciate you taking part in that and giving us the information. And again, if anybody has any questions that you'd like Mark to ask David, how about you type those? You can go into the chat feature and send a direct message to Mark.
I'll put my email in there.
Yeah, go ahead and put your email in there, and that way, if there's anybody with questions, that would be a great way to get information. And then Mark, when we do our next journey meeting, which will be in March, then you can come back and report again.
Sure.
You know, try to do some monthly reports. I think that's a great idea. And anytime that somebody's doing research, writing a book, you know, we'd like to have information that anybody has, or if there's questions, you know, that we want to ask that particular author.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great idea. Real quick, I'm going to do a share screen, and I'm going to go back to our website again. One of the things that you can go in the video section, and there's a little clip that I made. It's about three, almost 4 minutes. It's a commercial for JFK Custom Tours and Robin Brown. Something that nobody had done before was to actually, you know, in The Men Who Killed Kennedy, they showed Ed sitting on the Stimmons Freeway and pointing to where he was at, but nobody actually took a car and made a reenactment. So I'm just going to play this real quick. We did it while we were down in Dallas 1 year, and I think it's a way to you know, the people that you know, have the myth, or, you know, are purporting it out there that Ed didn't see what he saw and he couldn't have seen the car, and describe, you know, what he had seen before. This video shows right from where Ed was at on Stimmons Freeway, and where, you know, what he saw inside the car, and then reported to Brian and Casey when they wrote the book, Beyond the Fence Line. So let me just hit play real quick and you can see it. And this right here is what Ed saw, and how close he was. This is without any zoom on the camera. So with just just his eyesight, that's what he would have seen. So, you know, there's nobody that can say that he wasn't able to see directly into the car. So if anybody wants to see the rest of that, it's also in, split screen. You were actually able to see the point of view from Abraham Zapruder, and then also what I was in the car and filming the trip through Dealey Plaza. So you're able to actually go back and watch split screen the car itself going through Dealey, and then also as if you were in the car, what it would have been like. And I can tell you, it was pretty damn eerie, you know, riding in an open convertible going through Dallas, holding the camera. But if you get a chance to go back and watch that video, it's a good three minutes and 40 seconds that you can view some footage down in Dealey. Also, I want to throw this out there to everybody. Here in the next week to 2 weeks, I'm hoping I'll get it done this week, but I've got a lot on my plate. I'm going to release for the first time something that we've had filmed for quite some time, that was released strictly on the DVD and the Blu-rays and the digital copies. But Brian and Casey and myself, we would take groups of students down to Dallas to the scene of the crime and let them, you know, see it in person. We haven't done that in a few years, but we would do basically a virtual walking tour. It was a walking tour. Now it's going to be a virtual walking tour. You're going to be able to actually go on to our website and our YouTube channel. And if you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, make sure you hit the subscribe button so you know when the new videos will be posted and you can watch them. Instead of having to search for them, you'll be able to just click subscribe and you'll know when the new videos are posted on YouTube. And of course, they're on the website as well. But I'm going to put up the walking tour. Now we go through all of Dealey Plaza's areas. We've gone to the rooming house. We also end up in Oak Cliff, and we had Jerry Dealey as one of our special people that would give us information. And he took us into the jail, and we reenacted. And some of the high school girls, so, you know, you kind of have to, you know, give a little bit of credit to them. They reenact as if Oswald was coming out and Ruby, you know, shot him. But that's also filmed, down in the basement of the jail. So, I'm putting it out there for everybody that has not had an opportunity to travel to Dallas. And even those that haven't had the opportunity to take, Brian and Casey's walking tour. This will give you a chance to see it, you know, on YouTube and on our website. So that will be being, you know, dropped hopefully this week. And speaking of Casey, I want to bring Casey on. He's been, working on a new PowerPoint presentation, researching a book that is, gaining attention. It's gaining momentum, and I'm hoping that here within the next 30 to 60 days, I want to bring on a panel of the author, also bring J. Gary Shaw into the mix because he's got a lot of information on the book. And with that, I'm going to turn over to Casey and tell us what your research has been working on here that's been taking up your time for the last few months.
All right, David, I will. I'm gonna do a 2-hour presentation in Olney for David Denton's students, as well as the crowd of individuals that we hope are there. And the presentation is based upon obviously the new book out, Coup in Dallas, and I'll hold that up. Okay, is that backwards? Or can you guys see that?
Oh, we it's backwards in your camera, but we can see it.
All right, so I've read the book twice. I had to primarily because it's a difficult book to go through. And real quickly, has anybody else had a chance to read this book? Okay, well, several of my colleagues have called me up and they said, well, I got through the first chapter. I said, okay. But they said there's too much information, TMI, too much information, too many names, too many organizations, okay? And I said, well, then let me go through it. And I've been through it, like I said, twice, and I have 650 slides. Now, you got to understand I'm a teacher. So I'm going to go through those slides and cut them down to about an hour each. So I'm going to do a 2-hour presentation on the coup in Dallas, obviously by Hank Alborelli, and also the other two authors would be the co-authors, I should say. And those co-authors, basically, I've been in touch with. Leslie Sharp is one I've been in touch with on a daily basis. And I keep in a daily basis update with Gary Shaw. And in fact, I think his wife has adopted me as of yesterday, either that or cut me off, whatever the hell. So, but for the most part, I'm in contact with these people and asking questions. Now, again, if any of you have ever read any political science books, this book is very much political science. I mean, you're going to have to take a dictionary with you to try to figure out what all the material is. But at the same time, I'm a history major, and as a history major, this is right down my alley. And as it was right down my alley, I knew a lot about this stuff. And so I could pinpoint exactly what actually took place in Europe during World War II, what was going on with the OSS, at least according to the material in the books that I have read. So to parallel some of this, I'm doing a presentation on coup in Dallas, and I'm also taking the Scorzeny papers and putting them back to back. So my primary sources will be the Scorzeny papers by Ralph Gaines, and also the coup in Dallas by Hank Albarelli. Now, I'll use their documents to the best of my ability, but to try to point out what they are trying to say. And I'm going to use a couple of phrases that Larry Hancock used, the terminology that we use, that most of us are looking at, is conspiracy. And that term has been turned upside down, sideways, stomped on, whatever you want to call it. But at the same time, when you go over a lot of law dictionaries to try to figure out what conspiracy is, well, I think that the murder of John F. Kennedy was a conspiracy. I wouldn't have been on this for 58 years if I didn't think it was a conspiracy. And I think a lot of the material that leads up to this, not only do I believe it was a conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy, but I also believe that there was a conspiracy to set up Lee Harvey Oswald and a conspiracy to cover up this thing for 58 years. And I continually talk about this at university level and also high school level. But at the same time, I'm also realizing that a lot of people don't read like I do. And I'm, or even like some of you guys out there that are doing a lot of the number one research on looking at the documents and getting access to the documents. And so I have to try to synthesize what those things are and synthesize what is in these books and bring that out into a formidable way that my students would comprehend and understand this. And I can totally understand why a lot of people who would read any of these two books would sit back and say, oh, my God, there's no way I can get through this. So I'm going to go through that, and I'm going to present, and I'm not going to say a comprehensive point of view, but I'm going to highlight as much as I possibly can. For example, in the book, they go into an organization called the Collège. Okay, well, it's a French terminology, but the reason they go into it is because they're talking about the type of people that were in the Collège during World War II, and a lot of these people who were in that particular organization were there to protect themselves from the Nazis, okay? And so basically what they did is they went out, they went out and they became murderers. And this organization was still kept in place at the end of World War II, and it was absorbed through several organizations, and one of them, the major organization, would be NATO. But NATO is not going to come out and tell you directly that this is an organization that we kept. But we did. It was under wraps of the military intelligence, and part of the people that was used during World War II to go out and kill people. Okay, and these individuals became killers, and our military intelligence, British intelligence, and then later on our CIA, through the auspices of NATO, actually used these people and set them up as a murder for hire thing. And any organization that says that this doesn't exist will tell you that it doesn't exist. And I, go out and try to find it. But what Larry Hancock said, if this were a real conspiracy, then we would expect that our government and our agencies and our libraries and our archives would allow us to see this and allow us to sit back and say, okay, yeah, it was a conspiracy. But you can't do that. And most of you know you can't do that because the damn thing's been locked up for 75 years. And so we go out to individuals like ourselves to try to figure out what is going on. And I know you guys have been called names, and I can't even begin to tell you the names that I've been called. But at the same time, I'm going, I want to find out the truth. And I think I might take a step in what I would say is the right direction. And that right direction for me is that if the Scorzeny papers as well as coup in Dallas are anywhere close to being correct, then I'm going to sit back and say, I think we know who did this. But I think for a lot of you guys, you don't have to read these books, okay? But I think for you, you already have that same idea. But the Scorzani papers, as well as Ku and Dallas, they actually pinpoint names, and they tell you dates. And the two primary sources that I'm using are the date books, are the journals of these individuals. That basically these guys were not supposed to keep journals. Good CIA, Bureau of Narcotics individuals, and Office of Naval Intelligence and Military Intelligence are not supposed to keep these documents. Well, the document got out, and it got out primarily because these guys passed on, and the wives of these individuals got a hold of this, and then you have individuals who will go out and do research, investigative journalists, and they find out that there are these books out there. Now, trying to verify, you know, whether they're correct or not, it'd be like going to the damn National Archives and trying to figure out whether they're correct or not. And I know there's people out there, I'm looking at them right now, that go to those archives and try to sit back and say, well, you know, this is what the United States government says. We're going to follow this by book, by order, all the way down the line. Okay? Well, wonder if there is no by book or by order. Or wonder if it's never in the National Archives. Well, that's what Larry Hancock will say. Maybe it's going to be in journals. It's going to be in date books. It's going to be an individual research material that where a person has passed away and they've donated it to a local library. And so after 58 going on 59 years, I think that's where we're at. There are times that I will sit back and I'll curse the United States government based upon the idea that, you know, open the damn archives. Well, what are we going to find in there if they open up the damn archives? You know, if you go back during Watergate, you'll find out, at least depending on what journalist gave you the information on this, is that E. Howard Hunt went to the National Archives with several bottles of Whiteout and razor blades. And what was he doing? Okay, well, a lot of you guys can figure out what he was doing, but at the same time, do we know that that's what he did? And what did he do? With what? And how did he get in the National Archives? So, you know, you have information that's floating all over the place, and so everybody questions everybody. And I know that that's a relatively First Amendment right for all of us, and I'm glad that we're doing that. But I told my wife the other day, I said, I'll be glad to go to my grave right now knowing full well that I think I know who killed JFK, why they did it, and maybe some of the assassins. And in this book, at least Ku and Dallas, they point out a little bit the idea that a lot of the material individuals that we were looking at to begin with were anti-Castro Cubans and sprinkled with the military intelligence, and a lot of that is not in there. But the military intelligence is in there. And the anti-Castro Cubans is not necessarily in there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't there, okay? Because the person who's running this thing is total CIA and military intelligence. And if this is what took place and this guy kept records on this and it coincides directly with what the Scorzani papers are, and I know a lot of you guys are going to sit back and say, well, you know, you're going to take this with a grain of salt. Well, I'm taking everything that I get with a grain of salt. I mean, my God, I try to listen to 2 to 3 to 4 different radio and TV stations about what the hell's going on in our world today. And I think JFK would roll over in his grave if he could roll over in his grave if he could see what was going on today. And one quick thing I'll leave you is that, and I know I've tried to put this aside, but I don't think I can. In 1963, the national debt in the United States was $62 billion. You want to go back to 1963 and a national debt of $62 billion? Now it's over $30 trillion. And I went out and asked several people, I said, are any of you guys worried about paying back the national debt at $30 trillion? But hell, most of the people in the United States had no idea what that was. Nobody cares. And the reason they don't care is because they're trying to work
for that God almighty buck in order to be able to pay the damn gas prices that we have today, let alone anybody reading any of this material will sit back and say, what are you, an idiot? Well, yeah, I am. I'm an idiot. And here's the thing. I'm going to continue to do so, and I'm sure you guys are too, but I'm going to present a two-hour presentation on coup in Dallas, coupled with the Skorzeny papers, and about four or five other books and authors. And I guarantee you, it's an eye-opener, and it's probably one of those things that you probably should look at and read, even though I know a lot of you will sit back and say, it doesn't fit what I've been thinking. It doesn't fit all of the documents. Well, you got two primary sources, and I think those primary sources are excellent. And I know people will say, no, they're not. So, but anyway, I wanted to point out to you that's what I've been doing, and I'll present that at least sometime on our program as well as in Olney. So,
hey, can I say something?
Sure.
This is Dan Storper. I just, because I have also, like Casey, spent a lot of time with the book, a lot of time with Leslie and Gary, and I do want to emphasize what I tell people, you know, who pick up the book, is the importance of both reading some of the simple core things that are part of this, which include, you know, the limited analysis by Dick Russell in the beginning, the introduction by Dick Russell and by Hank Albarelli. Alan Kent's essay on a well-concealed tea.
Right.
And also reviewing the detailed entries of the datebook, which are transcribed. And I think, you know, for those of us that have been paying attention to the assassination for, you know, some time, the core question of, you know, going beyond people like David Morales and others is based on the idea that there was some central planning operation. And what this does, if you believe the datebook, as I do, it takes you to James Angleton and likely Tracy Barnes as the primary coordinators, you know, manager, coordinator of the plot, with other characters who you may not know about, like Jean-Pierre Lafitte and Otto Skorzeny. And the thing about Lafitte is he has a proven track record in some of these realms, both that Hank Albarelli had researched and that, you know, through my own investigation, met people who worked with Lafitte and did a lot of things like what Lafitte was about in that period. So I think there's a key thing that there's a way to look at this book through the introduction, the datebook itself, without getting lost in all the, you know, the background and history, which has its own value, but sometimes is a stumbling block.
Dan, I totally agree, because I've had to try to explain it to my neighbor next door who's 85, and he doesn't know very much about the assassination to begin with. I kind of got him hooked on it, and he says, well, I want to read the next book, and I said, no, you don't. Jeez. But he read the first chapter, and he says, you need to come over and explain it to me. But I think you're absolutely correct. We get caught up in some of these historical documentations about and in each chapter we'll go off to another area, and in that other area I think what they're trying to show us here is that the types of people that worked in these areas during World War II and after World War II, the types of individuals that would go out and kill people, and a lot of us will sit back and say, okay, well we have trained assassins in the United States Army. Okay, yeah, we do. We have trained assassins, but I mean, to me, a lot of people have said, well, I don't know if these guys would actually go kill the President of the United States. Well, if you're a trained assassin, you don't necessarily kill the President of the United States, but at the same time, get somebody who's outside. And I think that's what they're saying. And boy, the steps to bringing these hired assassins in was remarkable, fantastic, because of Elsie Skorzeny. And, you know, if you wanted a woman in history, you got one. And she's using her organization as a front
to bring these assassins in, and nobody even knows. Nobody even knows who she is. And, wow, I mean, it almost reads like a novel or somebody would put on TV as a movie. But my God, for answers, I think the coup in Dallas and also the Scorzani papers are excellent at trying to define things that are inside as also on the outside.
I want to also add that there's a global coalition that is outlined in the book that basically talks about not just the historic components of it, but the way in which, the right wing and center right came together, hardcore anti-communism. That was a system that was established, and it indicates, higher level collaboration. So I think, unfortunately, it is long and it is detailed and you can get lost in it. But as I said, if you focus on the introductions and the date book and some of the key elements here, I think proving that Tracy Barnes was the kind of the day-to-day coordinator for the agency. And it wasn't just rogue players, that it was, in fact, an actual planned coup at high levels of the government is the essence of this. And I think it goes far to really, for the first time in a certain way, really explain how that, essentially both came about and how it was run.
Totally agree with you, Dan. Thank you.
All right. Well, Casey, thanks for the update on that. And we look forward to seeing that very soon here and also at the conference at Olney Central College. And again, you can go in there or you can go to Olney and get in for free, or it will be live streamed here on Zoom. With that, and again, there'll be new information showing up on the events tab later on this week. I'm going to call next on Bob Saltzman. He wanted to give us an update on something he's working on, and I believe it has to do with the executive action. So, Bob, you still with us?
I am, David.
Go ahead, Bob.
Not to go off on the tangent that you warned us about earlier. I just want to say it's good to see you in the road to recovery. I have a number of close friends who went through similar experiences, including children, so I'm glad that you're getting healthy. A couple of meetings ago, may have been the last one, I can't remember, the conversation about events in historical perspective, this whole effort came up, and one of them referred to the movie Executive Action, David Miller's film came out in November of 1973. And I don't recall the exact details, but I commented on that. I had been asked by David to compile information that I had on this, having participated in that with Mark Lane back in the day. And I have done that. So, David, I forgot to send you email about it, but I've captured all of the material. I'm not sure, since it's I guess it would be classified as a softer, more peripheral historical issue versus the intensity of the kinds of things that the group tends to talk about. So I'll leave it to you to determine whether there's value in sharing it. But I thought putting together a few slides just to revisit the history of that movie. I have the trailer. I could play that if you want, but I suspect that most of you have either seen the movie or the trailer. So again, I've digitized a great deal of information and I have it available. I created a repository, and that was the one that Rick had referred to earlier, where I put a lot of films. I have not populated it yet with the executive action information because David had solicited that for his website, so we will talk that through. So it's not intense, but it's historically valuable, I think, to look back to those early days and how the producers of this film were trying to educate the public and it was more than just the film. Those of you who recall, and I can't remember who brought it up, I think it might have been Casey, was the infamous newspaper-type format document that was handed out to everybody who bought a ticket in the theater. The distribution was reasonably wide, but the attendance, you know, was certainly not what you'd expect with a blockbuster. And I have all of that material. I have posters from all over the world. I have information from Mark Lane and Donald Freed, who wrote the book. And then, of course, Dalton Trumbo converted it to the screenplay. And those of you, again, who are familiar with the history of the Red Scare and the McCarthy era, and, you know, the name Dalton Trumbo. So there's a very interesting little web here. And I'll leave it to the leaders of Project JFK to determine whether there's anything more you'd like to share in this forum. And just as long as I have the floor, just one other question. I had read and reread Pink Thompson's latest book, and if there's time later on, I would be intrigued to hear people's opinion on what Professor Thompson has conveyed in his new book, if you've read it, Last Second in Dallas. So those were the comments I'd like to make. It's good to see everybody here, and I hope you're all well.
Well, thank you, Bob. Yeah, definitely. Anything that you can share on that, I think it's important. That was one of our first films to bring out. Well, actually, I think that before JFK, that was the one that everybody pretty well went to with Executive Action. And then, of course, Stone's film JFK came out in 1991. So I like revisiting the past, which is what this case is all about. So anything that you want to share on that, you know, absolutely, I want you to share it. And definitely anything that you have in the repository, you know, definitely, you know, send that to me or send me a link to where it's at, and then we can get that put up on the website.
Okay. You know, Bob, this is Casey Quinlan again. I just wanted to point out, yeah, I think I was probably the one that brought up the idea that going to the theater at that particular time, 73 and 74, where only a handful of people were there, but we got access to all this printed information, and I think it was denoted that about 95% of what is written down was accurate, and you had it all documented. So yeah, that's very good material. But I want to point out to you about after reading the book Coup in Dallas, the first thing I did is go get my film out on Executive Action, and I'm sitting there going, wow, these guys must have had some hellacious material back then. But then part of that is Professor Scott. A lot of that material comes out of that out of his research material too. So yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Is there any value of anybody seeing the? It's about a 2-minute and 50-second trailer now, or we'd hold it off to another time.
Let's hold the trailer off for another time.
Okay.
But I. Any clips or anything that you want to show? I'm kind of concerned about, you know, as far as copyright infringement that YouTube will flag the video as we're trying to get it uploaded. So,
right.
You know, let's hold off on the trailer. Obviously the trailer is on, online. Everybody can look it up, but any still or anything that you want to show? Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that.
Okay, I'll do that at a later time. I'll put it together as some coherent, you know, slides. I found the pictures taken that I took at the opening in New York City on November 7th of 1973. You know, again, not intending to be name dropping, but, you know, Burt Lancaster was there and David Miller and the staff of the group of people who put it together, in particular Ed Lewis, who was the producer. It's a fascinating story how they got that movie done. So.
Can I add something? I'm friends with Steve Jaffe, who pretty much wrote most of that handout material. He was a press person who had worked with Garrison and was very close with Mark Lane, and so he wrote that handout material. And there is a, I think there's also, I think he showed at Kappa, one, kind of a piece that basically was about the making of executive action. And he's a good contact, you know. And obviously Donald Fried is still around, but very busy. And so, you know, there is an interesting backstory, and this, the making of the film piece that Steve presented as well, I think discussed it as well.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and move on. I'm going to pull up Beverly Sadowski here. She wants to talk about something here with the Z film. So let me unmute her, and she can tell us what. So I can click on mute again. Let's hear what Beverly's got to add here. Beverly. Bear with me just a second. Okay, Beverly, we can't hear you. There's a little icon in the bottom left corner that is a microphone. If you click on that, you should be able to unmute yourself. Okay, yeah, you're still muted. Let me see if I can help her out here real quick. Okay, right next to the microphone, you'll see a little up caret. Click on that and make sure your microphone is clicked same as system, and let's try that. Okay, now she's unmuted. Go ahead and say something, Beverly. And, okay. I tell you what, since your microphone is having an issue, or it's showing unmuted in the list, but at the top where your icons are, you're still muted. Go ahead and it says unrecognized. Close out of Zoom and then come back in. But before you go, write this down, just in case your link doesn't work. The ID number is 884-8848-4438, and the passcode is 312-518. Just in case your link doesn't work, you'll be able to click join a meeting. But try that, and we'll see if we can get you to back in so you can speak.
David, she's logged in twice to Zoom, one with the microphone and one without. The one with the microphone stays unmuted, or stays muted, but the one without the microphone is also.
Okay, I see her in twice. Let me click this one here and see if this will help out. If you're logged in, joining us through Eventbrite instead of through Zoom directly, sometimes it will show unrecognized on your camera or your microphone, so you always want to try to join in by Zoom.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to let, so we can go ahead and move on. Beverly, go ahead and log out of both of your logins and log back in again, and then we'll see what happens with your microphone. Okay, the code is 8848844438. The passcode is 312518. Okay, thank you, Beverly. All right, while we're waiting on Beverly to come back in and see if we can get her microphone to work again, let's see here. Love technology when it works. Anybody else have anything that they would like to talk about?
Be interested in Thompson's book comments, if anybody has any.
Hi, this is Patrick McCarthy in Northern California. I think that Tank's book is of great merit. And for those of you who have not read the book, the information concerning Alvarez and the acoustic evidence and the way it was handled during that period of time where they had a so-called blue ribbon committee or whatever it was, all the exploitation of that, including the nuclear test off the coast of South Africa, is all worth reading from my point of view. I just wanted to see if anyone had any comments about that aspect, including Alvarez's background as a person, sort of a go-to person concerning providing academic credentials for certain points of view.
I think that the interesting references to the veracity of neutron activation analysis is worthy of a conversation as well, because that's taken this investigation in various directions that may no longer be viable.
Well, those two gentlemen were from the Lawrence Livermore lab, and true experts who I think blew the NAA out of the water. And I think the FBI is also now withdrawn from supporting that type of analysis.
The more problematic issue is the jet effect. It still continues to have resonance amongst the defenders of the official story, to the shock to some, even some people that believe there was a conspiracy, but believe that all shots came from the rear. But the jet effect, I'm just surprised that the jet effect remains, to many people, a viable explanation of the president's head movement after he was shot.
That's a good point. There's an article by Cyril Wecht and Gary Aguilar, which I think can be found on Kennedy's and King, that website by Jim DiEugenio, which goes through an analysis of the various theories that have been used to support the single bullet theory, so to speak, that being NAA, the jet effect, and seriatim, each of those theories proposing that the Warren Commission was correct, I think effectively rebutted, blown out of the water by the Aguilar and Wecht article, which is...
Yes, I think the problem is that we continue to see quote-unquote scholarship, particularly this guy Nally, who published in a publication that actually allows the author to select the peer reviewers, and also allows them to determine who they do not want to review their articles. That continues to come out. There continues to be apparent scholarship supporting the jet effect as the explanation for why the president's head went back and to the left, and therefore that the wound in the front was the result of the shot from the back coming up. And I've also seen, in connection with that, the argument that the to counter what Tink said in his wonderful documentary, that it wasn't that the motorcyclist drove through the plume, not that the plume of blood and debris hit them as a result of a shot from the front, but they there was this cloud that was then blown by the wind into the motorcycle. So these are all the theories that are still out there that are regurgitated and used to, I mean, you know, as recently as a month ago, I had a large debate with someone about this, and they were citing these studies. And so anyway, just letting you know that those are still out there.
I would add to the refutation of the jet effect the high likelihood of him getting shot twice in the front as a result of David Mantic's and Doug Horn's observations after the ARRB. You know, to take two bullets in the right front of your head is really going to throw your head back.
I remember many, many years ago being invited to speak at Dartmouth College and was blindsided by a face-to-face debate with Dr. John Latimer.
Ah!
I was going to see how many people shook their head or went, whoa. So you should read his report if you're interested in this topic of the so-called jet effect, but he has, I won't waste time here, but he has a long history of having tried to prove this in the most unscientific method you could imagine. And his credentials, by the way, and I don't demean it in any way, but he's a urologist, or was a urologist. He passed away.
Beyond that, Bob, beyond that, if you look at the ARB interview with Dr. Jones and Dr. McClellan, that was the third doctor, in that transcript, you'll see that he actually was a buddy of Hoover. And that
Latimer was.
And that would appear to be the basis or the origins of, or at least I'm going to infer that is the origins of his defense of the Warren Commission report.
J. Edgar Hoover probably had more influence on everything in so many ways. Beyond even the scope of the Kennedy assassination. So that's a whole, you could have a Project Hoover website.
Yes. I think you could say there were two cover-ups. There was the initial cover-up. Well, there were two conspiracies. One was to kill the president. And I believe Hoover led the conspiracy to cover up the truth. Partially, I believe, because, he had been given a number of warnings about mafia intents to kill the president. Now, whether you believe the mafia was involved or not, but the point is, I think there was a major embarrassment on his part. Plus, I think there were some things that he did not want to be revealed. But clearly, as the investigative arm of the Warren Commission, you know, and the agency that was charged with investigating the murder of the president, that I believe he was the person in charge of the cover-up.
Well, you know, J. Edgar Hoover made the trenchant observation, I think it was the day after the shooting, talking to LBJ, that he believed that someone had been impersonating Oswald in Mexico City. So that even he brought that up and said, this is a real problem. And
of course, there were some people that then argued, I think McAdams in particular, that Hoover misunderstood or wasn't aware of what the evidence was at the time, that he made a mistake. But it wasn't, Patrick, wasn't there an interview, or someone might know this, wasn't there a telephone conversation that he had with the president for which the tape is not available?
Yeah, that's something that Rex has written about quite in detail and persuasively, which is a gap in the recording. However, as I understand it, Rex has located a transcript of it, and it includes the portion where Jan Gruber says to LBJ, there's one part of this which is very puzzling, which is that someone was impersonating Oswald, and in effect, he says, this creates a lot of problems. We need to get to the bottom of that.
Oh, yeah, that was the afternoon or the morning of the 24th, the 23rd, but I believe there was another conversation, maybe the night of the 22nd, or a different conversation on the 23rd that is missing. I don't know, maybe, Joseph, do you have any?
Well, Rex has a right for the 14-minute gap.
Yeah. It's very good. Very good. Another thing that Hoover definitely would not want out was the extent to which there were FBI contacts and knowledge about Oswald prior to the 22nd.
Right.
That was, you know, both for the CIA and the FBI, neither of them wanted that information to be public because it goes against the thrust of the lone nut that we had no reason to believe this guy was a threat and he was a lone nut. It goes against that because, in fact, as the excellent work, the book Ghost, for example, goes into, and also Our Man in Mexico shows that, you know, Jefferson, Jeff has shown that there was a lot of not contact per se, but information known about Oswald for quite some time prior to November, you know, 63.
Yeah. I mean, there was clearly, both, he had motivations both personally and professionally but you know, he's the one that was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, was it 3 o'clock in the afternoon? He told LBJ and he told RFK that they had their man and the way the FBI was run in those days. Once the director said that's the conclusion, you know, and then he didn't use his expert Cuba people, right? He used different parts of his agency to investigate. So he clearly was preventing, I think he was at the head of the second cover-up. And I don't think that, I don't think the first conspiracy it didn't matter whether the autopsy was botched or not or deliberately, you know, misguided because they were so well concealed that there was no way they were going to be found.
Well, this goes down as the quickest crime ever solved in the history of law enforcement.
Right.
There's no way you could have looked at any. I mean, there's no way you could have interviewed all the witnesses in that short of period of time. So
right.
when Hoover speaks, everybody listens. It's like, as you know, what Hitler, the quote of Hitler is, you know, the more often you tell a lie, the more people will believe it. Oh.
Well, and that's why the FBI took possession of all the evidence. It got manufactured over the weekend. They cut out everything, was sent to the FBI Friday night, and suddenly things are found. And, you know, evidence is found and linked. But anyway, I just...
That was Goebbels, by the way, not Hitler.
Oh.
That's right.
The bigger the lie. That's what it's
bigger.
The bigger the lie. Right.
Yeah, Joseph Goebbels, yeah. Good point.
Well, you know, a lot of this was not lost on the Warren commissioners themselves because when there was the declassification of the executive sessions, they're complaining about this very thing to each other, saying that they're being undermined and their investigation is, in effect, being guided and to some extent thwarted by the position that the FBI has been leaking out about the FBI's conclusions so early on. And you have transcripts of the very commissioners themselves complaining about this.
Yeah, they're saying that they've never had, it's not the history of the FBI to reach a conclusion. It's hard to get them to reach a conclusion, much less so quickly, right? And then, of course, there's a discussion about how do you get rid of this ugly rumor about Oswald working for the FBI? They said, well, you get Hoover to write a unsworn declaration. So... And then you have Dulles questioning McCone and Helms about what the CIA knew when Oswald was in Russia. So you have the man that was the head of the agency at the time, the man who is his successor, what the CIA knew. He knew the answer to the question, and he was helping the CIA protect itself. You know, I mean, who in the world would have a former CIA director taking a deposition of the current CIA director about facts and things that happened? The questioners watched.
Well, especially when in the executive session, I believe Dulles tells the other commissioners that he would anticipate that a CIA agent would lie under oath.
Yes.
Dulles said that to the other commissioners.
And to the president.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and would lie to the president, you mean?
Lie to the president to protect the president.
Yeah, so even Dulles was saying they even if they were under oath, they wouldn't tell the truth.
And of course,
and the commissioners became well aware of this, and they felt that they were handcuffed by the FBI, which is their chief investigative agency.
Right.
They're only out their conclusions by the end of December 63. Yeah. Unless someone can correct me. I believe this is right in the transcripts.
It is. They obviously were not aware of the way the CIA was not telling them the truth. I mean, you know, since 64, no one knows about the assassination attempts of Castro. But the FBI, they clearly complained about, and they were startled that Hoover issued a report so early. You know, they were saying that they never, it's hard to get the FBI to reach a conclusion. Here they are, reach a conclusion, you know, and then they complained about the quality of the war crime.
Yeah, and then the other aspect of that was, why would they take, and this is, I think, Harold Bob said this, why would the FBI take a position that they were ruling out any possibility of conspiracy so early when there wasn't really a sufficient opportunity to do a full investigation of all the potential associations? Why would they take that position so strongly so early? This is Bob saying that, if I recall correctly.
I mean, I've been trying to document the ways that the lawyers the way they conducted their unrecorded interviews and what went on after they went off the record to show how they intimidated the witnesses and try to coerce their testimony in a certain direction. And Dr. Curtis gave me a lot of good information, which I'm working on an article to document, but you know, people oftentimes look at the testimony, but you should look at when they went off the record and, you know, try to find out what happened either off the record or before they even interviewed. If you speak to a living witness that, you know, was interviewed by the Warren Commission, it'd be good to ask them, Earl Warren specifically allowed the staff to do unrecorded pre-deposition interviews with witnesses, which did a couple things. One, they were able to screen out the problematic witnesses. But number two, helped to, what's the word we should use, Patrick? Shape their testimony.
Not that they would ever coach them.
That's right. Just tell them that, you know, you're wrong. It couldn't have happened that way.
Yeah, and choose witnesses not to interview, such as the girl on the stairs. I guess everybody is familiar with the Girl on the Stairs volume by Ernst, and it's very well put together. He took a long time to put that together and did a lot of personal research, and it's convincing to me. Why didn't they get her deposition? Vicki Adams, yeah, that's it. And they avoided her testimony like the plague. And I think it was maybe Bellin who was aware of that testimony. And there was also a letter that was written by a former assistant U.S. attorney that was essentially a corroborative of Vicki Adams' boss, who was also standing near the stairwell during that period of time, which is, by the way, within 90 seconds after the shooting. It's a very good book, Girl on the Stairs.
Well, and
hello. Yeah. I was going to say Barry Ernest is the author, and he was interviewed in Oliver Stone's documentary quite at length, and he brought in that other supervisor of hers who actually confirmed the stories of Vicky and Sandra Stiles.
Yes.
Yeah, and they didn't talk to her because they said, well, why should we talk to her when we've already got you?
Well, and they also, if you read Barry's book, because he goes into a lot of detail, Vicky was practically, she was single. I believe she had been an orphan or something, and she didn't have much family, you know, to support her, you know, so they were able to easily, you know, shove her aside, you know, in this whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, I've been in and out because I'm at work, and there were just two things that were talked about earlier that I just wanted to briefly go over. And first of all, because a lot of this information is actually in my book starting on page 44, and it has to do with the Faith Beverly Brunson's research, and she wrote a paper called Phantom Ambulance and Blood on the Ground and the Big Runaround. And where she, you know, she made a case, you know, for that second Secret Service man. And then when you read the story of Bertha Lozano, who was the nurse at the triage at Parkland, who prepped a gentleman in a suit with blood work and everything, and then the actual hospital admittance never went through, but she was interviewed, and she spoke about, you know, having prepped this person, and they brought him in, and they had his suit coat covering his face, you know, on a gurney, and then they never heard from, you know, that patient again. And after researching this quite a bit, a colleague of mine actually identified this guy as Chuck Robertson, who disappeared after November the 22nd, and his family continued to receive his paycheck indefinitely, mailed directly to his home. So, and the other thing about the second limo stop, and if I may, I'll take the screen here for a second. This is a chapter that didn't make it into my book, but it talked about that, and it had to do with the second limo stop. This is a map here. If you see this, they were describing the entrance ramp onto Stemmons, okay? And I've been here, and I have actually walked this area here. And this is the position that Officer Brown was, and he testified before the Warren Commission. And it's under Volume 6, page 232, regarding his position. And it says clearly it's over Stemmons Freeway. In other words, they make that turn off Elm and go up. So they were coming straight towards him. And he talks about in 1981, in the continuing inquiry, Gary Mack interviewed Jesse Curry. And this is the actual passage from that publication. And it says the motorcade came to a virtual halt on the access ramp to Stemmons. Patrolman Earl Brown was on the railroad overpass, which spans Stemmons, not the triple overpass, underpass. Okay, it's the one over here that I just pointed out, all the way over here. Yeah. And saw the cars coming to a halt for nearly 30 seconds as it approached him. Okay, now that's a lot of time. And my hypothesis on that is that a second Secret Service agent went into the limo, and they went all the way over to Parkland, you know, with the second Secret Service agent. But a lot of this is documented, so it's just a matter of putting it together.
Larry, also, go ahead, Casey. You going to talk about Ed?
Well, first of all, Larry, could you put that back up on the screen there? Yeah, Brian, you can join in here because basically, you know, we had Ed Hoffman who basically said, and a lot of you guys had questions as to whether or not Ed could see behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. Well, I believe this photo was either taken on that day or the day after. But at the same time, Ed was standing right around in this particular area. Do you see where you have the David? I've got my pointer here, but you got okay. Okay, Ed would be up on the Simmons Freeway. Okay, do you see where Simmons Freeway is? You see where Earl Brown is, and if you go straight down. Okay, Ed would be on Simmons Freeway. And Ed was standing at a position where he could see behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. And the thing of it is, when we did research on this, we came across a 14-foot tree. You go down there right now, or you go down there, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, you had trees all over this place that was blocking this area. This is that 14-foot tree, okay? And Ed was up on Simmons Tree when he could see right behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. But we had a lot of people sit there and say, oh, hell, he couldn't see because there were trees all over the place. Hell, that tree is almost like a bush, but it's a 14-foot tree, okay? And it was not blocking any view of Ed Hoffman. And so we've had a lot of people who were distracting everything and saying, Ed couldn't have seen this. And plus that who's your buddy, Brian, that wrote
Jerry Posner?
Yeah.
Yeah, more on number one.
He's our guy, one of the biggest guys left alive. Maybe he ought to run for president.
Ed told us that he said every time we'd ask him about the Secret Service car, he said it stopped. He said it stopped long enough that he could run up, as he ran from his position, the car was stopped long enough, but he never mentioned, of course, we didn't ask him, but he never mentioned anything about somebody else jumping in the car. But Larry, put your picture back up for a second. Earl Brown, I love law enforcement because that's what I did, but this is the same officer who said he smelled gun smoke, almost 10 minutes after the assassination from his position. So I find that really hard to swallow, but he was up there. At least that's what he was assigned to be there. Whether he was there at the time or not, who knows?
The thing about Earl Brown is that obviously they didn't ask the right questions. All right.
But, yeah.
This here coming from Curry, so belated. I mean, 1981. I think it's very, very significant here.
Yeah.
He was, and he saw that the cars, the convoy come to a halt for nearly 30 seconds. Now, I want to go back to the blood on the ground, because the Warren Commission did their darndest to place that blood over there on the service ramp next to the school book depository. Okay, so they tried to discredit Gene Hill. They tried to discredit several other people, saying that it was soda pop or something like that. But Jerry Coley, who was a witness there, he was standing with his buddy Charlie Mulkey there at the corner of Houston and Maine, and they ran over there and they saw the blood. So these guys worked for the Dallas Morning News, so they went back to the Dallas Morning News and they got the photographer Jim Hood, and Jim Hood runs over there, takes pictures, he dips his finger in the pool, he tastes it, it says it's blood. Take several pictures, okay? And then, all of a sudden, a few days later, the FBI knocks on their door at their newspaper, and they wanted to see the photos. Like, well, how did you find out about this, Oh, well, it came from, of all people, Ainsworth, And so, the photos obviously disappeared, But Jerry was interviewed, and the interview is on YouTube, and I have it up on my blog, the entire transcript and everything, on Black Op Radio. And he is still extremely lucid, and he tells the story about Jim Hood eventually actually disappearing, another one of those mysteries. So years later, they asked the Texas Ranger extraordinaire, Clint Peoples, if that pool of blood was related to the assassination. And he said, you better believe it. And you better believe it. It had, definitely had something to do with the assassination. So, again, it's all in the book.
You know, Larry, let me point out to, another thing, too. Ben Jones Jr. came across with some information, especially about Secret Service agent Robertson. And I may be out of line here and may not have it correct, but I believe Robinson was a Secret Service agent, but he was assigned to the Dallas Division. And it was my understanding that when I first read about this that Pam Jones wrote is that he had gotten a teletype readout. He got the information while the limousine was on Harwood Street, where the Dallas Division of the Secret Service was located. He got it, ripped it off, and, of course, read it and then yelled at somebody. He says, I've got to go out and stop the limo, okay? And I've been looking for footage on this forever and a day as to did anybody go up and try to stop the limo. And apparently there were several eyewitnesses that said that there was a man who ran up and got in front of the car and was yelling, was waving his hands back and forth to stop, and I think
and got his butt kicked.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's the guy that disappeared, and not only disappeared, but still received checks on a monthly basis for I don't know how long, because like he was still working. But if you were to ask his wife and kids, he completely disappeared off the face of the earth.
That's right. That's right. And another thing, this thing about the second ambulance running around wild, which was first written around about by Beverly Brunson, but then later on, years later, it was picked up by Jerry Rose of the Third and Fourth Decade, and he wrote an article, and he also verified. And if you read the transcripts of the Dallas Police Department radio logs, it's right there, you know, that a Secret Service agent was felled in the line of duty. So, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of machinations here going on, and still part of the mystery.
Yeah, it just it causes me to sit back and wonder when David Liston's going to finish his book, because I want to see what he has in there, especially on those stops and especially who he thinks might be that maybe he's going to talk about a Secret Service agent there. But then also John Newman has a new book coming out too, where he is going to give information about Lyndon Johnson's right-hand man, Burris, which I think maybe we ought to start looking at coming up in the future too.
Yeah. Also regarding Liston, he was the first researcher who noticed, and the Daniel film is the one that's taken right from that spot where the ramp starts coming off the Elm going on to 35 East. And that spot right there is where the Daniel film was taken from. And everybody's seen it. The limo is coming straight at them and they're waving and whatever. But when you slow it down and you analyze it with good imaging techniques, you can see that there are more people in that limo than are accounted for. And you can see because, in fact, a friend of mine who worked in Hollywood, he's the one who noticed that, and he contacted me and he said, have you looked at this? And I said, well, let me check it out. And you can see that there are several people, you know, additional to the drivers at that point, where everybody else is supposed to be on the floor, and Clint Hill, but there are two other images, figures in that limo, and then all of a sudden it's blacked out, and then, you know, and David Lifton's the first one who caught that, and he said at that time, look, if this is real, then you know, everything that we've been told about what happened on Elm Street, about supposedly Shaney going up to Curry, telling him that, because also you can see that the motorcycle cops are not even close to the limo. They're still lagging behind. All right. So that the whole Daniel film completely changes, you know. And the reason I point this out is because the Daniel film did not appear until about 1979. All right. It's because the family said, hey, you know, this might be of evidentiary value, so they donated it, you know, and And that's how that came about. It's not a film that was around from the beginning. All right.
Well, is that publicly available now?
Yes.
The Daniel film.
Daniel, yeah. I have I'll text you. I have an analysis on my blog with the pictures and images and everything. I'll just put a link up there, right?
Well, while we're speaking of films right now, I had Beverly Sadowski. I was going to bring her on a second ago, a few minutes ago, and she had microphone problems. So let's see if Beverly can. She wanted to mention something on the Z film. So Beverly, can you try now?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah. I guess my problem was that I didn't enter in on Zoom. I entered on Eventbrite because I teach classes on Zoom and I've never had difficulties getting on before. So I guess maybe that was the issue. But yeah, before I get onto the detail, I just want to also reiterate a lot of things that Casey had said earlier, because I was a teacher and I have, like him, I'm the truth seeker. I don't have an agenda. I don't have a theory that I need to defend. I have read everyone's books, okay, because I'm not going in with a closed mind or a theory that I have to defend or whatever. And I now teach six-week courses on the JFK. I've done this for the last 6 years. And, and one just on the medical evidence, just strictly on the medical evidence. And I've also spoken to a former Warren Commission member in person on occasions, and one of the only two living Secret Service agents from that car. So I've been doing this for 58 years that this has been going on, certainly as the years that I've been an adult. I was 13 when it happened. But I just wanted to say, in terms of also the executive action, one, I was doing talks. I did have a FBI agent that came up to me after one of my talks, told me he worked in the Crystal City area at the time, and that they were told to go around to the various venues and confiscate that film. Whether that's just an anecdote or not, but that's what he shared with me. But I do want to say, as far as the Zapruder film, because nobody, at least maybe when I was off here, mentioned about the interviews that Peter Janney and Doug Horn did with Dino Brugioni from NPEC in terms of the Zapruder film and the events that occurred that weekend. So I'm not defending anybody or whatever. I suggest everybody go to that Zapruder film mystery and listen to that. Dino Brugioni was the right-hand man of the director of NPEC there, and listen to what happened that weekend in terms of the Zapruder film. And the fact that we had, around 50 people who talked about a car stop, including those police officers that were closest to the limousine.
Yes.
I think it's something like Casey, where he said, you know, he's looking at, you know, this, and I read Who in Dallas also, that book, and I read Scorsese papers, and I know a lot of people even here, sometimes people want to defend their what they believe is right. I'm open to whatever. And I don't try to discount anybody's ideas. And so I would just suggest that if you're unfamiliar with that Zapruder film mystery, that you go on YouTube and check it out. Because there were so many people, like I said, once closest to the limo, including police officers, that spoke about the fact that that there was a stop, not long, there was a stop, and we don't see that in the Zapruder film.
What's the significance of the stop, though? Are you suggesting, is it just a human reaction to hearing an unexpected shot, or are you suggesting that there was a deliberate effort to make sure the president was killed?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on that. We can all draw our own conclusions. But what to me is more important also in this is the fact that if it was the government that had control of that film over the weekend, maybe that's the more important part of this, okay? That it wasn't Life magazine. So if we think it's the Zapruder film as the be-all and end-all of it, maybe the most significant part of it is the fact that it wasn't Life, but it was the government that had control of that film. Maybe that's the more important thing. I'm just suggesting that. Like I said, I don't have any book or theory to defend, but I just keep an open mind.
So the theory, so then the significance of if there was a stop, what you're saying is it's not what a lot of people say was, oh, that means the driver was involved in the conspiracy. It goes towards the fact that it raises a question whether the Zapruder film was intact.
Exactly.
Okay.
I'll even take you a little step further. The police officers flanking the president on either side. Okay. Their testimony and their documentation really wasn't even released, or at least all of it hadn't been released until about 1971. And one of the Dallas police officers on Jackie Kennedy's side, basically, he said he stopped his two-wheeler, and he saw one of the Dallas police officers right next to him run in between both cars, and after he set his motorcycle up, and he said, yeah, he says he ran in between both cars. So the question would be to him is that, well, did the cars stop? And he goes, well, yes, they did. And then they asked him where they thought the shots were being fired from. He says, I thought there was 3 to 6 people firing from the North Grassy Knoll. Now, you know, for us who were just looking at the lone gunman and maybe 1 or 2 shooters from the North Grassy Knoll, he said it looked like there was several people on the fence line, maybe 4, 5, 6 people shooting at the president from there. And I'm sitting there going, what in the hell is he talking about? Which a lot of people, when they started reading this material, would sit back and say, it didn't happen. And we do have people in our own community that sit back and say, oh, no, that's false. Really? Who said it was false? You have an eyewitness, and you're going to sit back and say, it's false? I had a lot of my students who were questioning some of the eyewitnesses that we brought into Dealey Plaza. Gene Hill was one of them, and I remember this one kid, and he was a senior in high school, and he says, well, Mrs. Hill, he says, you were standing right here? And she says, yes. Now, he says, well, what about the shots being fired back there from that 6th-floor window? She goes, I don't know anything about that. I don't know anything about shots being fired. I'm telling you, I heard 4 to 6 shots being fired from the North Grassy Knoll. And he was adamant. He goes, well, what about the shots up here? And she stopped him, and she was a teacher, and she says, look, I'm the eyewitness here. I'm the one who said that there were shots being fired from the North Grassy Knoll. And when I tell you I don't know about any shots being fired from the 6th-floor window, I'm telling you I didn't hear anything there, and it was not significant to me at that particular point in time.
Let's go back to the Zapruder film for a second. I'm just trying to run this down to determine, are we dealing with Drosh or Gross, or are we dealing with the real ore here? So are there any extant photos out there that suggest that there were brake lights that went on?
Yes.
Okay.
I think the most important.
My second question would be: would these brake lights have been obvious from the Zapruder film from his angle?
Yes.
Okay, Bob. Do you have, what is your take on? Because you're the friend of the man that believes that the Zapruder film was not tampered with. Have you discussed it with him?
Croden.
Right.
You know, Larry, I've talked to both Robert and also Tink. And both Robert and Tink are not going to go back on this. They are going to say that Zapruder film is intact. And I'll tell you what, I'm not a film expert, but I can pick out 4 frames right now where you can see that the film has been altered. And I'm sitting there going, what is this?
I guess I'm asking if Bob had discussed this with him.
Are you addressing me, Larry? This is Bob.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I stepped out of the room briefly, so I heard my name. I don't want to complicate the conversation by saying I've had any recent discussion on this matter. There's the very interesting abnormality in the frame, I think it's 316,
right,
that was of some contributory nature with this discussion about alteration of the film. Casey, it's my understanding too that both Robert and Tink have not varied from their position that the film is intact. But I don't want to claim any expertise on this. I've read and seen some of the arguments. It's not a blind devotion to defriend Robert as much as that I haven't seen anything right now compelling me to change my view on it, but it's not a contemporary answer to your question, Larry. Sorry.
Well, I'm asking you if you had the opportunity to ask this question or discuss this issue with him in the past, and if you did, how he explains away this issue. I'm just curious.
I just can't recall. It was not in the recent enough past for me to give you everybody else an answer that.
When you spoke to him, did you, I know that there are some people that have a vested interest in saying the Zapruder film is intact. I was just curious if, you know, what the explanation would be that if there are other films out there that show brake lights going on and they're not obvious in the Zapruder film, how does one, you know, how does someone who believes the film was intact, explain away that phenomenon?
Well, before Casey answers that, let me interject something here real quick. I'm going to share a screenshot.
Okay.
If you have not, go on YouTube, okay, type in JFK assassination, video proves limo stopped. Now, most people I've talked to have never seen this video. It was done November 12, 2015, and the guy actually, I don't know if it's the guy that actually is the one that posted, I'm presuming that it is, but what this shows is Kenneth Allen James' new color filtered analysis of the infamous JFK Muchmore film, proven even more so that the films redistributed to the public, labeled as assassinated footage, are doctored, films meant to deceive the world. Okay, what they do in this video, and I'm not going to show the video, I'm not going to play it, but I want you to go look at it. It's 6 minutes and 51 seconds. They use technology of putting filters on the film that brings out the color. You can see just in this clip right here, the brake light comes on. Now, do we see that in the Zapruder film? No, we don't. But also, again, look at the fact of where the person is that's filming this in the Muchmore film. You're actually looking right at the back of the car. So if you want to put it to rest, did the car stop? Did the brake lights even come on? This 6 minute, 51 second clip is going to show you definitely they came on. So if you haven't seen it, again, video JFK assassination, video proves the limo stopped. Just look at that when we get done with the meeting. And then here's homework for everybody. Everybody that's still in attendance. I think there's only like 29 people in attendance at the moment. Everybody go look at this video. Next month, we're going to discuss.
Well, I just wanted to offer one observation just to make a distinction. There are various ways that films can be altered. And I think historically people have thought about the altering of the film as the removal of frames or frames disappearing or potentially being replicated. And then there's what you're talking about here where a frame or multiple frames was, let's say, retouched or doctored. So the reason I bring it up is because a couple of hours ago there was a reference to the Nixon Muchmore films being shown in sync to suggest that either the Zapruder film was or was not changed. And my context of thinking that through was the addition or deletion of frames. This, David, I think you're talking about is another element of alteration, which would be either the appearance of or disappearance of content that's in the emulsion of the exposed film.
Aerial imaging is what was available in 1963, what could have been done. And I don't know how many of you attended 2019 conference in Dallas when some filmmakers presented their work.
Yes.
Larry, I know, was there, and you know, because of problems with the sixth floor museum, they have not completed their film. But when they showed that film, a trailer from what they were trying to make, I will tell you that I happen to know Grodin walked out during that presentation. Okay, people who were there were very impressed with what that film showed. Okay, so again, I just think that we need to, you know, keep our minds open. Yet there are people who, all of their theories are based on the timing of the Zapruder film, so that's why they want to deny that it's altered. But I think we need to keep our minds open on that, and with the significance of, and it may be ironic that he looked like he was going back and to left so much, because not only was there aerial imaging done in terms of the wound, but it made it speeded up the frames and made it ironically even more obvious that he was shot from the front. So that's just something else to think about.
I'd like to suggest something just as a matter of context, which is simply that it is not utterly dispositive whether the brake lights went on, because there's different areas of discussion, which is, one, the brake pedal was touched and the limousine slowed down noticeably, and that the motorcycle officers noticed that, and other people like in the Secret Service limo noticed it slowed down. Then there's a separate argument that no, it stopped and that's been covered up. But those are two different points. It's not dispositive per se.
I'd like to take the screen here for a second. In 2014, okay, Tyler Newcomb, the son of Fred Newcomb, okay, who did telephone interviews with all of the motorcycle cops. Before he did that, he sent them bootleg copies of the Zapruder film. And this is in the last chapter of my book, because this is so significant, okay? And during the summer of 2014, I went ahead and transcribed hours, okay, of those conversations. And like I said before, these are like dead men speaking from the grave. And one of the motorcycle cops who was completely ignored, and who Beverly Brunson baptized as the Knoll Rider, Douglas L. Jackson, with whom I also had contact with his son, okay, during my research. And the four motorcycle escort, let's rewind for a second. The only two that were brought before the Warren Commission were Hargis and Martin, for a total of 7 pages, all right? The guys that were closest to the action, the guys who witnessed JFK getting his head blown off. So the other two, James Chaney and Douglas Jackson, were ignored completely, okay? Then in 1971, the FBI said, wait a minute, it might be time to go ahead and interview these guys and find out what they saw.
And what side were they on? Were they on Jackie's side or the
On the right side. On the right side. Okay. Chaney and Jackson, obviously. And this is the exact, and I actually verified Douglas Jackson's voice with his son. All right. And he confirmed that this was his father speaking. All right. And this is a transcript that's 15. There's another one which is 6 pages long. But what I want to focus on here, okay, and I've underlined it a little further down because, right here, okay. Okay. He says, there were four people that came out of the follow-up car and run out to either side of that presidential limousine with rifles of some type. Did we see that in the Z film? Ladies and gentlemen?
No.
Thank you. Okay. And then he asked him, really? What happened? Explain. between second and third shot, I believe, on both sides of the car, and they ran on both sides of the car. Right. Okay. Now, when he's talking about the Z film, he said, Life magazine printed that picture of that film, but it's been cut up. It's been edited. Part of it's been cut out. Okay. And this is an actual witness. All right. To the events of the day. Now, you know, it's pretty obvious. And let me say, and let me add also that all the other, the Bobby Hargis and David mentioned it, had, he ran in front of, in between the two limos, which means that the limos were stopped. He had enough time to do that. All right. And Bobby's not the one who said that. It was James Chaney, the one who said that. You know, he said, yeah, I know Bobby, you know, he parked his bike and he ran right in front of me because we were all stopped completely. You know, now this is the real deal, you know, and that's why I emphasize it in my book on the very last chapter. And I supplied the reader with the transcripts of those conversations. I also have the MP3s, okay, just in case. And so that's
Hargis. Did that person interview Hargis as well?
Let me tell you, Hargis. Yes, of course. I have all of them. Okay. I can send them to you. Hargis had been talking about limo stop for years. When what's the name? The UK researcher Griggs. You know, he interviewed him. You know, and he said that limo stops. The limo stops.
Right. I want to go back to the cloud of the blood spray. And you may not remember off the top of your head, but this is based on the conversation I had last month, that he's reported to have said that he was hit so hard that he felt he was hit himself by a bullet.
Yeah, Bobby.
And, right. But then when you read his warrant commission testimony, it's really vague, and so people are using that as that he drove into it, into the cloud, as opposed to it hitting him immediately. And I'm just curious whether Hargis had any other more specific information about that particular moment.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Again, it's all in my book where I even, there's a video where he's saying, yeah, you know, look, I had this thing stuck here on my, next to my mouth, you know, and
it turns out to be, you know. Right. And when he got back, the police station, it said, what's on your lip?
That's right. But he wasn't the only one. You know, all of them were sprayed with blood and debris, you know, even Jackson and Shaney, who were on the right side. So the Newcomb tapes, I think, provided us with the smoking gun evidence of a limo stop, you know, especially because all of them talked about the limo stop, some, you know, a little bit more time than the others. You know, so I think you have to take that as a given. You know, the tapes, you know, do not lie, you know. And like I said, you know, I have those tapes. I've had them. And it's, you know, clear cut as far as I'm concerned. That's why.
It's 71, so it's pre-HSCA and pre-R.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And let me put in a plug for Larry's book, because I guarantee you it'll be a book that you will not, you know, want to put down. When I first got a hold of the book, we read it all night long just before we gave a conference presentation. And I sat back there and I sat in the room with Larry for probably about 2 or 3 hours talking about this. And I'm sitting there going, no, I have not read this. And so when he gave us the book, I'm sitting there going, you got to be kidding me. And it is very well documented. Yeah, the JFK, the Horseman.
How long has it been out? I'm not aware of it.
Wow. That came out in April of 2018.
Really? Wow. Okay. Is it a hard copy?
No.
Oh. That's why I don't have it.
And definitely,
get it, Larry.
You guys can order the book. If you go to prodigyfk.com, you can follow the link and order his book. I know it was available, and I'm sure it still is. It was in black and white and color. Be sure to order the color version, because it's so much better than the black and white. Brian made the mistake of ordering, you know, the cheaper one in black and white, but get the one in color. because you'll be able to see the transparencies, the work that Larry's done. It's right up my alley. I do the same, well, not the exact same, but I'm on the same lines with Larry in the audiovisual and the technology side. And, you know, his, that book kind of became, so to speak, our Bible for a few years. And I remember when we, went to Olney, that's when I got a copy, his copy that he had with him. And, anyhow, we,
and also because the hero of the book is right, next to you.
Yeah. That was, I mean, the idea was though, was, I got the book that Larry, his own private copy, and, I brought it over to Casey and Brian, and I'm like, ah, look what I got. You know, I mean, they were, where the hell did you get that from? Well, I told them, you know, that we had sit down and talked and stuff. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we spent the evening, and then on the ride back, which was about six and a half hours back to Kansas City, basically Brian was our reader in the back seat. I'm driving, Casey in the passenger seat, and we're like, and Brian's reading. He goes, Taylor, look at this. I'm trying to drive.
David, but you're not telling them what you did. You brought it in about 11 o'clock at night, and we had to speak the next day. And I'm in bed, and I'm sitting there going, okay, you just turn the lights out. And he goes, well, I'm going to read this to you. And I said, and I rolled over, and I just said, what? So I got out of bed, and the next 6 or 7 hours, we're reading this book. And I said, pull this out. Let me see what Rivera's got here. I said, God, I want to be a little bit more intelligent when I come down and sit down and talk to him. But at the same time, holy cow.
Well, and the reason why it was so late, I brought it into the room. I was busy reading that after I got off the slot machine at the bar. So, you know, I had to take a little bit of gambling time and then reading time and pulling out, you know, eventually that's when I started doing what you do on books and started putting post-it notes on every section that I had to read to you. And, yeah, we spent the whole damn night reading that book till about 4 a.m. And we were actually going to call Larry up and go, hey, I know it's in the middle of the hour of the night, but, we've got the coffee going. Come on down, buddy. We want to speak. But we did that the next day, but that was one of the highlights I remember of that trip.
And not only that is that Beverly Brunson is, you practically your kin.
Yeah. She's right from our area. So. Yeah. And that's what brought us into knowing about Beverly. If it would have been for the book.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I had to sit back and eat crow, and he goes, well, where are you from? I said, Kansas. And he goes, well, Beverly Brunson's from Kansas. And I had to ask Larry, I said, well, how big do you think Kansas is? Do you think I know everybody in Kansas, Larry? I mean, for God, I know Dorothy and Toto, and, you know, and they're right down the road from me. I mean, I get people from New York saying, hey, they come into Kansas and they go, where's Dorothy and Toto? I said, hell, they're in Nebraska. What the hell? Did you ever read what?
No, and not only that, yeah, and then Gary Shaw, who's here in this meeting, you know, he provided a picture, a high school photo, and that's when I was, oh, my God, I wish I would have had this for the book, you know. But Beverly was so ahead of everybody else, of her peers, you know, in the assassination investigation thing, where from the beginning she said, look, you know, all of the images, all the photos and film have been doctored, period, you know. And you know, and then she had that incident where she was kidnapped and drugged and you know, she was lured, first of all, you know, and then kidnapped and drugged, you know, and as far as I'm concerned, they tried to kill her, you know, and why would they want to do that, you know? You know, and she was just cranking out paper after paper and sending them to Weisberg, you know. And fortunately, Weisberg, you know, put all of her work in his repository, and that's why we know, you know, of her research.
And that was between 1966 and 1968.
And that was it. And then after the Joplin, which I call the Joplin incident, after that, she disappeared.
Joplin incident?
Yeah. When she was lured by somebody who lured her by wanting to talk about and see JFK documents. And then she was drugged. She was kidnapped and drugged, you know. Yeah, yeah.
Who is this?
Beverly Brunson.
Oh, wow.
And Larry, if you want to know a lot about her, buy the book. She's in the book.
Shameless plug. You know, it's funny because I used to correspond and talk to Solandria, Vince. And Vince, one day said, you know, that's really crazy what happened to her, because believe it or not, he would actually, I would send him some of the chapters and he would read them, you know, and suggest, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, not really, you know, leading me, but, you know, he was interested. And when he learned about Beverly, he said, man, you know, that's crazy. I thought if anybody would have had an incident like that, it would have been me, you know,
wow.
Because he was so much more visible, you know, than her. Yeah, but what happened is, all of her, all of her mail between her, she and Weisberg was being open and read, so that's why they knew about everything they were doing.
Wow.
I want to throw this up here real quick. On prodigyfk.com, under the videos tab, look for, and this is from Gary Keene's show, the new JFK show number 237. Me and Larry are talking. This is right after we got back from Olney, and J. Gary Shaw gave us the picture of Beverly Brunson.
Yeah.
But the video here, you know, talks a lot about her. So if you want to know more about her story, pull up the YouTube video on the Prodigy FK website, and you can find out what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Casey, are you suggesting that the dog that played Toto was not a native of Kansas?
Well, it depends on what tornado picked it up and brought it into Kansas, and then the tornado that took the dog out of here. So, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, I've got a slide on Coup in Dallas of the man behind the curtain. And once you see the man behind the curtain, see who the curtain is. I used to have Johnson behind there to help Nelson take care of his fantasies about LBJ. But at the same time, I just sat back and I go, when you see the man behind the curtain, I think you'll know who we're talking about. But it's not Toto, so.
Okay.
Remember, Toto's pulling the curtain back to expose.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Casey, the Secret Service agent Robinson, Chuck Robinson, that story you related, can you think off the top of your head a book where one could read more about that?
Forgive My Grief, Penn Jones Jr. And it's he's got four.
I'll send them to you. I have them on PDF. I'll send you those books. All right, by PDF.
Oh, God bless you. Please, thank you. And speaking of that limo stop, I indict driver William Greer as participating in intentionally. Making sure the bullets landed in the Z film, you can see him look back once and then twice as the thing is slowing down and he's looking, he sees the head explode and then he turns and goes forward in contradistinction to his Warren Commission testimony, case closed about Greer, in my opinion.
So you think that evidence that he was involved in the conspiracy to kill the president?
I see him keeping the limo slow until the headshot, and then he turns and accelerates.
But you're saying that he had foreknowledge of an assassination, and therefore he was ensuring that the task was completed.
Well, Bruce, before you answer that, Larry's book goes into this, and he goes into it very well, and he says that it's very possible that there was a police officer in front of the limo that had stopped. And if that motorcycle police officer stopped in front of the limo, then the limo has to stop or he'd run into him.
Yeah, he pretended to have mechanical problems, and that came from Penn Jones Jr.'s Forgive My Grief. That's who I cited in that.
But the driver was not trained. He was a Secret Service agent that was not trained as, you know, to be that in that position. And
I think one of the interesting things is that...
Wait, Rick, real quick, if I could respond to what was just submitted. To imagine a motorcycle cop in front of the limo causing the limo to slow down at the time of the shooting implies a massive alteration massive amount of films and photographs where there is no such motorcycle in front of the limo.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a post, and the one cop who in the Newcomb tapes actually spoke about his position was Officer Freeman, Harry Freeman. All right. And if you read his the transcript and you listen to the conversation, he said that that's exactly where he was while they were on Elm Street. So, you know, that motorcycle is not seen in the Z film either. You can see them when they make the turn at the top of Elm briefly, okay? And then they disappear, and, you know, what happens next, you know, with the Z film. But it was Harry Freeman, the one who had that position, according to his own information, the one that he spoke to Fred Newcomb's guy there in the Newcomb tapes.
I think one of the interesting things, though, about this is I read where JFK's regular limo driver had died of a heart attack like 6 weeks before the assassination. And so William Greer wasn't even his regular limo driver.
Oh, exactly. So he was not, and he was not trained, you know, because a trained driver would have immediately on the first shot gotten out of the lane of traffic and taken off.
Well, they said that witnesses saw him almost, he jumped the curb there at the top of Elm, at the curb.
So let me ask a question. Whenever this comes up in some of these chat rooms, I just want to see what the collective's response is, because I don't have a good answer to this question, is that if the Zabruta film was tampered with, why would they leave enough evidence to present a possibility of a frontal shot? Why wouldn't they have just completely doctored the headshot so that it was clear it was coming from the back?
Because it's all, you know, what we have available now with CGI and everything wasn't available then, for one thing. And the other thing is, remember, the film was suppressed. Life magazine paid all that money for the film. And did they ever use it? Did they ever license it out? Whatever? No, because so the intention was there's only so much they can do to take out of the film. Do we see any debris flying back? Do we see Jackie picking up anything? But what's important is the fact that they suppressed it.
Okay. 12 years.
I want to unsuppress Joseph's comment of there is no motorcycle in front of the limo causing the limo to stop. This is BS.
That came from Penn Jones Jr.
That did.
Yeah. And the only one who spoke about being in that position was Harry Freeman, and I have him on tape talking about it.
Yeah. You know, the bad part about this whole thing is that what's in question is the whole damn film.
Yeah.
And so, what was it? And I think it was Robert Groden said this is the
it's a timeline of the assassin, something.
Yeah,
like that.
And I just sat back and I said, okay, yeah, and I bought that as a young researcher. So what did we do? We equated everything from the Zapruder film. And then if you actually get some of these documentations and you sit back. And, you know, here's the thing, too. And I know we have, just by looking at the people out there who are looking at documents and trying to get the release of the documents, God, I support you guys 100%. And I learn something every day with what you guys actually do with these documents. But at the same time, you know, I mean, we're going in 59 years after this. And I have to question, obviously, I'm not going to be around that long, but I have to question, you know, what teachers are actually teaching this. And Beverly, I 100%, I would love to come up to your classes up there, and you know that we've talked. But at the same time, what are kids doing at the middle school level, at the high school level, and even at the college level? And here within a month, we will find out what the college students are, at least in Olney, we'll find that out. So I praise you guys who are going through the documents. Larry Schnapp, I tell you what, we laugh a lot, but I guarantee that, you know, the work that you guys do, Joe Backus, Bart Camp, you know, all you guys who do these documentation things and try to get them out to us so that we can have a much better or maybe a clearer understanding about what took place back then. I praise you guys 100%.
I got to tell you, I am really, and I think I can speak on behalf of the other lawyers, but it's really frustrating to see some of the mistakes that were done historically on the legal side. For example, when Marina, in the mid-90s, Dick Russell got together some lawyers, and they couldn't think of a way
to force the issue forward. And, you know, Texas had this court of inquiry proceeding that actually was going to be the original proceeding to evaluate, to investigate the president's assassination. And then in 2017 that, you know, some people advised of, you know, some of the interests, the entity, the community not to pursue, you know, Trump's order. And it just, it's so frustrating with the passage of time. We're trying to do the best we can. But it's, another part of the story that, and then you have Jeff Morley who, you know, has been had a decade long battle. So, but the one thing is, we have these, you know, Bella Alba developed some really, important information in her public, in her hearings in 1975, in November of 75, about how the Warren Commission improperly, classified the information. And, the JFK assassination in many cases created really good law for the FOIA, for the Freedom of Information Act, but it's really frustrating. Patrick, you're going to add something?
No, not really. But it's, I wouldn't fault the community so much as
the lawyers.
You know, the power, no, it's the power of the government to suppress things. It's immense. There's immense suppression.
Yeah, but we're not taking it, you know, our group, we are saying we're going to fight these guys, right? And,
oh, yeah.
And there were opportunities in the past where people rolled over, and it just is very frustrating when people, when there were living witnesses alive that we could have used, and now we're stuck with the historical record as it is.
It's true. A lot more could have been done. A great deal was done by people that, when Alan Dulles said in closed session, nobody's ever going to read this anywhere.
Right.
And they put out the report before the election, and then after the election, they put out the evidence, thinking the 26 files wouldn't really be looked at. And yet there are many intelligent people who've gone over every single page, like Sylvia Maher, as well as James Weiss.
I'm talking about the lawyers. I'm really frustrated with the lawyers because of what, you know, we have to deal with. And it's just, you know, I'll just leave it at that. And just we're doing what we can, and we're you know, we got a very aggressive group of lawyers, and we're going to be like a bull in a china shop, and we're going to fight this tooth and nail. We may have to go to the Supreme Court if we have to, you know, but we may lose, but we're going to go down fighting if we have to.
Something else I just want to kind of throw in there is because I always think of weird shit. If they would have made any more alterations to the Z film, we probably would have just wound up with a thumbnail instead of the actual feet of how many we actually, you know, how much footage we actually do have. But yeah, to answer that question earlier, I mean, how many more cuts and stuff could they make? Well, they could have just said, yep, he was on Elm Street. Boom, he got assassinated. So, but the only thing we have left to show you is just this one frame. And it's not even the car in the 313 frame. It's just up the street on Houston. So I guess we should be glad for what we do have in the films.
Before we go, I have something of interest here. I'm doing a show with Douglas Horn on Wednesday, I believe, regarding something that he talks about, you know, in the Stone documentary. And I'll put it up here. It regards Robert Knutson or Knutson or whatever. And in the show, he says that this came from the ARB in 1993, but it had been suppressed by the HSCA. And the HSCA deposition of Robert Knutson, and he was a photographer who, you know, during this interview, first of all, he put up a lot of resistance to be deposed, especially on certain items that he thought were classified because he had signed and he had sworn, you know, secrecy and whatever. And the pictures that he had taken, specifically he talks about taking color pictures, seven sets of 12 color pictures, colored. And they actually called him in because they didn't have a photographer who was doing color. And he recalls not only the pictures that he took, but also that he took pictures of JFK with probes, you know, stainless steel probes in a sitting position where these probes were going through, you know, tracing bullet tracks, all right? And when I read this, I was flabbergasted because, I mean, if there's ever been like a smoking gun document, it has to be this one. And it's up there on Mary Farrell. And it's a tremendous, tremendous document here regarding what he saw and, you know, and everything regarding the autopsy photographs and everything. And like I said, you know, he had to get authorization from a guy by the name of Goff, his supervisor, the head of the Secret Service at the time. And here, this guy, Goff, who was the general counsel of the United States Secret Service, actually the lawyer for the Secret Service, which probably goes right to what Larry had been talking about, where the Secret Service destroyed, you know, all of these records, you know, right before the ARB in 1995, you know, and they destroyed records of that year regarding, you know, Secret Service and JFK and whatnot. But this is a very important document, and I would behoove everybody to read it because it really, you know, he talked about the probes, he talked about the color sets, he talked about the number of sets or prints, which were more than one set. It was 7, okay, and each set had 12, all right. And like I said, the one which was a right profile with JFK propped up sitting and all these probes, you know, going through, you know, through the cadaver. All right. So that's it.
All right. Well, thank you, Larry. Right. Well, we're a little over 3 hours right now. So if anybody else has anything they want to add before we close, you know, go ahead and speak now, forever hold your peace, at least till next month. And speaking of next month, I'm going to try to have the date picked out this week. It'll also be on the events tab for the next Journey meeting. And we're also in talks with, I won't say who it is at the moment, but, you know, in talks to get, a speaker for the Spotlight series, since we didn't have a Spotlight last month, but, see about getting that done as well. So anybody else have anything else that they would like to add?
Just the only conference, which is a free and open conference, April 8th and 9th, and you're all welcome to be there. And again, like David said, if not, it'll be streamed on Zoom.
Yeah, and the details will be out, I like to say, after talking to David and having him on earlier this afternoon. As soon as I get the information from him, I will be getting that information out to all of you through the events tab. And again, I think we settled on $40 for streaming it on Zoom for anybody that wants to attend. Or if they want to come in person, it's free to go to. You just got to pay for your way to get there and your way back home.
And that $40 covers what, 2 days, David?
That'll be for both days. So, I mean, it's a one-time fee for the entire event. It's not per day. It's for the 8th and the 9th. And there'll be more details coming out. Like I say, hopefully we'll have them all posted. And then as we find out who the speakers are, as soon as I find out who the speakers are from David, then I'll get that information posted as well. So
has Doug Horn appeared on a Spotlight series?
I have put out the request. I know Brian has too, to Doug to come on and do, you know, a Spotlight series. I know last year he was pretty well tied up with a lot of the stuff with the Freedom Foundation. And great perform, you know, videos and stuff that they had done and interviews and little conferences. But I'm hoping that this year we'll be able to get Doug on. 1 month, I think he'd be a great addition to our Spotlight Speakers series.
Yeah. So I've been talking to him the last couple of days as part of my effort to really drill down on the specific time frame when the body could have been allegedly removed from the coffin, and he is really exhausted by this topic. He really wants to move on.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that he will do it, but he seems like he's done. And, you know, he's got a great legacy. If we ever have a Hall of Fame of JFK researchers, he belongs in there.
Absolutely, Larry. Well, if you get the opportunity to kind of throw it out there to him, I would really appreciate that on behalf of me and Casey.
All right, I'll be talking to him tomorrow, because he asked me to review something. Well, I'm actually supposed to review something that he did. He just revised specially for me to help with this question, and I have to get back to him. So I will mention it to him.
Okay, yeah, appreciate that. Does anybody else have anything they want to add? Well, I think we had a great meeting, our first one of this year. And again, sorry that, you know, it had to be in February instead of in the month of January like we thought was going to be. But, had some issues at the very beginning of the year. So with that, I want to thank everybody.
David, we managed to avoid having to force you to do any significant editing this time around.
Exactly. I appreciate everybody's help and assistance with that. Because that will make this video go on. As soon as we end, I'll be working on getting it uploaded, and the replay will be on within the next 12 to 24 hours. And again, check out the events tab. Because once I get a chance this week to do some updates to the website, the new transcripts of our journey meeting of the spotlight series from Craig Bozarth, those will be the first ones to go up, and they'll be a downloadable addition that you can take and print off or save it to your computer, however you want to do it. But definitely want to throw a big thanks to Craig for doing the time consuming trek that he has to do to do that for us. So it takes a village to run what we do. And again, everybody that has been making donations, I see that some actually make donations every month to us. The same individuals. Anybody that gets an opportunity and they would like to give us a donation on our website, that's greatly appreciated. And how you do that is go to projectjfk.com. Go to projectjfk.com. Under where it says Help Our Cause, you can get your name thrown up on the board, and you can click the donate button on PayPal. And, of course, because not saying anything about the government, but if you decide to make a donation, please make it under 600. So that way we don't have to hit the damn tax trap. If you want to make a large donation, just break it up into a couple payments. We're all good with that. So don't
do it like consecutively. Spread them out a little bit.
Yeah, there you go. So that keeps the lights on, so to speak. It keeps our website up, the different projects that we're working on and what we can bring to you guys, on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. So as Jerry Lewis used to say on the telethons, give till it hurts. We'll give you a Band-Aid. So with that, we're going to go ahead and close this month's meeting. I want to thank everybody that showed up, everybody that participated, and everybody that will be using or be viewing this on our YouTube channel. And again, if you have not subscribed, hit that subscribe button. That gets you guys to know when the next videos are going to be up. And with that, I'm David Knight with Project JFK CSI Dallas, and we'll see you next month, guys.
Guys, thank you.
Bye.